Log Talk Radio.
Well, good evening, everyone, and welcome to Web Sleuths Radio. It's our anniversary show, the JonBenet Ramsey anniversary. It's been 15 years. Can you believe it? 15 years. Now, some say JonBenet died on Christmas night. Others say she died early, the morning of the 26th, so we're just going to call it the 26th. Either way, it's a very sad anniversary and one that's very frustrating, because we all want to see justice for JonBenet Ramsey, and hopefully it will come soon, very soon. Web Sleuths Radio is brought to you by a wonderful organization called DreamCatchersForAbusedChildren.com. This is a nonprofit organization where their mission is to educate the public on child abuse symptoms, interventions, and preventions. Visit them at DreamCatchersForAbusedChildren.com. Okay, legal stuff. The opinions expressed on Web Sleuths Radio are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of WebSleuths.com, the website, which is a totally separate corporate entity, so leave me alone, don't sue me. Tonight, our guests include world-famous body language expert Dr. Lillian Glass, true crime author Donna Kaufman, whose latest book with Dr. Cyril Weck is entitled From Crime Scene to Courtroom, forensic psychologist Dr. Glenn Lipson. He has an amazing website. Be sure and check it out. It's makingrightchoices.com. And joining us throughout the show will be Web Sleuths and Forums for Justice members, including, but not limited to, Cynic, Zumama, Peggy Lakin, and hopefully later, Super Dave will join us. I've been trying to track that guy down. Kimster is our executive producer of Web Sleuths Radio, and she is our newly elected Vision Clearance Executive. Some people might say that's a window cleaner. I don't know. It just sounded good. Now, if there are any members of Forums for Justice or Web Sleuths and you'd like to call in and join in, feel free. The number is 760-825-0933. Now, before we get into the JonBenet Ramsey case, every week we are going to feature a hot-cold case from Web Sleuths. Now, this cold case we've chosen to try and make it hot again. Kimster, I'm going to turn it over to you. You go ahead and start talking. I need to get my dog out of here who's chewing on a piece of plastic. Okay, you go ahead. Tell us about our hot-cold case this week, and then we will get to JonBenet Ramsey. Go for it, my dear.
Web Sleuths featured hot cold case this week is Julianne Cecilia Gillette. She has been missing since June 1st, 1985 from Bellevue, Washington. She went missing when her daughter was only 11 years old, and her daughter has recently joined Web Sleuths and is asking for our help. Her daughter has told us that her stepfather and her mother had a heated argument over money just prior to Julianne's disappearance. Her stepfather never went to the police, and instead it was her grandparents who reported Julianne missing days later. Now, what I think is interesting is that sometime after her disappearance, a small bag containing her belongings was found in a lobby in Reno, Nevada. So there's a clue. Julianne's daughter has posted suggestions given her by the original detective in the case. He's not in the case right now, but she has stayed in contact with him. Please visit Julianne's thread on WebSleuths.com and see if you can come up with more suggestions to help bring Julianne home. Go to www.websleuths.com, and to the right of the screen is a link with a picture of Julianne, and you can click right there and it'll take you to the forum where Julianne's case is being discussed. I really hope that we're able to solve this for Julianne's daughter.
Thank you, Kimster. That's very, very sweet of you. And we will try, and definitely, I know there's sleuthers out there that can help, because at some point, you know, everybody needs a little help. And so let's try and help this cold case. It's our hot cold case of the week. You can go to websleuths.com to find out more about it. I think I found our popping noise. Zumama, I've put you on hold for just a moment because that popping noise, I believe, is coming from your phone. So hang tight. We'll try and fix that in a minute, but I've got you on hold, Zumama. Right now, we are going to go to a very special message. There is a man out there that we all know and many of us love named Steve Thomas, former Boulder detective, who basically gave up his career and a lot of his life trying to find justice for JonBenet Ramsey. And I asked him to write a message to all of us, because he thinks about this case every day, and he appreciates everything you do. So here is the message from Steve Thomas. Hi to all. Best wishes this Christmas season and wishing everyone well. This time of year is again a reminder of what many people, all of you, often feel and think about during the year. I know that not a day goes by in which I do not think about the victim and the case. 15 years is a long time. It feels much more recent. It certainly remains my wish that in this lifetime we see some sort of official closure to the case. In the meantime, God makes all things right and will certainly do so in this case. I recognize and appreciate many of you, and my thoughts and prayers remain constant for the many people who are involved in this case, many directly, some peripherally, but all of whom this case touched and who were impacted. I am grateful that there remains continued interest in this case, and know there are still committed individuals who would also like to see a conclusion to this investigation. I wish them the very best in those efforts. For 2012, I wish everyone joy, success, health, and happiness. Kindest regards from Steve Thomas. So there you go. It was very heartfelt and very, very touching. Okay, I don't even know where to begin with this. So I'm going to begin with Dr. Lillian Glass. Dr. Glass, you are a world-famous body expert. Okay.
Body language expert.
Body language expert. Excuse me. That's what I meant to say. Yes. Body language. You know the language of the body.
You know the language of the body.
Yes. Now, you have watched the interviews that John and Patsy have given over the years. John and Patsy Ramsey.
Yes.
What does their body language tell you?
Well, it's very interesting because it changed throughout the years. Initially, you saw a lot of nervousness with Patsy, a lot of what could be concluded as signals of deception, and then we came to find out later that the ransom note that was written was allegedly written by her. And there were investigators who specialized in linguistics and handwriting analysis, and they seemed to point the finger at her. So that's what you saw. And then towards the end of her life, you saw a calmer Patsy, a more resigned Patsy, and it was really sad to see the toll that this took on her and eventually her life.
Well, when you say you saw a calmer Patsy, do you think that means, obviously she knew she was dying, in her body language, Dr. Glass, did you see any hint of the fact that she knew what she had done, whatever it is?
What was really interesting, early on, you did see a lot of signals of deception, the nervousness, the swallowing, the hesitations. And also, there's something that was very, very strange that happened. And it dealt with a phone call analysis that they did on the voice, and they found that it was the son's voice that spoke out when
we're talking
Patsy
about the 911 call,
911 tape, and she said, "We're not talking to you."
That's what John Ramsey said. Yes, to
Burke. Allegedly.
Right,
Burke. Right. So that is really a very big thing because what happened? And then there was also allegedly he had said, "What did you find?" And the emphasis was on the word did. So something was very, very strange. Now, what happened with Burke? Did he compartmentalize everything? One of the things that I had done early on is to look at some of the drawings that he did when he was younger. And they did look kind of odd. They did look kind of abnormal. Again, maybe he was traumatized. Who knows what his involvement was? Again, it's inconclusive. I'm of the school where I really believe in the efforts of the FBI, and I know that the Ramseys hired John Douglas, who at the time was the former head of the FBI's Behavioral Science Unit, to examine the case. And that, you know, he came to the conclusion that the Ramses weren't involved, but he did not mention anything about Burke, which was interesting. And he did say that the criminal who did commit the crime was a young criminal.
Mm-hmm.
So that was an inexperienced criminal. So that was very, very, very insightful for me.
Let's talk about Burke's drawings. We're talking with Dr. Lillian Glass about the JonBenet Ramsey case. It's been 15 years since the death of JonBenet. Tell me about his drawings. He was 9 years old. What did you see?
He was 9 years old, and they had kind of a sexual content, from what I recall. Again, I don't want to accuse Burke by any chance,
right,
any stretch of the imagination. I'm not here to put blame on anyone. But they did look odd at the time for a 9-year-old boy, from what I recall. But I do see, you know, that it was also very interesting. The behavior of Burke was quoted a lot in the press at the time, and it said that Burke was very distant, and he would play with his video game or his little. I guess in those days they didn't have video games; they had little, electronic games, and he would play
mm-hmm.
with them and just kind of zone out. So, in essence, did he compartmentalize it? Did he put it in the back of his mind? Did he see something? Did he hear something? Does he know something? Again, we will never know. And certainly now that there's a renewed interest in this case, it might be interesting to see what is discovered.
Dr. Glass, what did you think of John Ramsey? Much has been made on the forums of him constantly licking his lips, almost like a sign of nervousness.
Right.
Do you feel he is being dishonest as well?
Well, I imagine they must know more than we do.
Mm-hmm.
They must know something. The whole thing is just too odd. The reactions that they had was very odd. The reaction that they had initially,
yes, it,
the reactions
it,
that they've had subsequently. It is odd. And the mm-hmm. way he has communicated in the Barbara Walters interview, I was looking at that, and just to see, you know, how he bows his head down, it just seems odd. You know, the human reaction to whether or not someone is being straightforward or whether they know more than they're saying or they're telling
mm-hmm.
the truth is very serious, because as human beings we're very, very knowledgeable, and we need to trust our guts. And if something doesn't seem right when we're looking at something or we're watching a video, most of the time it isn't.
Well, that's very, very true. Dr. Glass,
again, we're not accusing him by any stretch of the imagination. We're not saying that he had anything to do with it. Maybe he knows more than he's saying. That could be an issue, if indeed, and we're definitely not accusing Burke of being involved at all, because the family's DNA was it was told that there was no DNA evidence of anyone's at that point in time.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, but we wonder, does he know a lot more than he's saying?
Mm-hmm. Oh, I do believe so. I don't think there's any question of that. Let's go, Dr. Glass, we'll be back with you in just a moment. Let's
sure.
go to true crime author Donna Kaufman. Donna, welcome. You've been following this case since day one.
Yes, literally.
One of the big misconceptions that I want to clear up tonight, and we do have some new information, and we'll be talking about that in just a little bit, is the DNA evidence. And I'm gonna tell you just a brief story to kind of give you the example of the problem we're having with the DNA evidence. And then, Donna, I need you to comment, because you're my expert on this. So recently I was standing in line, and I was looking kind of in this mirror that was there, because like an idiot, I tried to wax my own eyebrows, and I one is a lot shorter than the other. And I'm looking at it in this mirror thing while I'm standing in line at a store, and this woman kind of looks at me funny, and I said, "Can you tell?" She says, "Yeah, what happened?" And I said, "Well, I rescued 5 kids from a fire." And she said, "You really did? Oh my God, that's great." And I burst out laughing. I said, "No, I accidentally waxed my eyebrow too much." I said, I had nothing to do with rescuing kids. And right then it hit me. That woman was ready to believe that stupid, ridiculous story without any question from a stranger. What does it do when somebody like Jane Velez Mitchell goes on the air and says the parents have been cleared because of the DNA. Here we have somebody that's supposed to be an expert and is a respected journalist, and they go on and say something that is totally false. No wonder everybody believes it. It's so easy for people to believe anything that they hear. Donna, what are your thoughts on the DNA and the problem that we have now getting the truth out about the DNA?
Well, 15 years later, and we are the ones talking about this case. You don't see the family members, you know, having forums and asking for help and let's keep this case alive. So that's what I wanted to start with. But I also want to tell people, we have a lot of people coming fresh into this topic, whereas we've lived it for 15 years. And Web Sleuth has a sister forum called forumsforjustice.org, which Tricia owns and runs. And that is the repository of everything.
Absolutely.
Ramsey. Mm-hmm. And you're going to find all the DNA information there, as well as all the information of all the scams that have been run on this case, and all the characters who've tried to pull tricks, and also all the wonderful downloaded material and files and all of that. So if we're going too fast for you, you don't know what we're talking about, you know, reverse engineer this and go look at that
forumsforjustice.org. It has been around since 2001, and we have the most amazing posters there that has everything you could ever want on the case. Donna, we're going to go to Dr. Lipson in just a moment, but Donna, explain why the DNA in this case, explain why when somebody like Jane Velez Mitchell says, hey, the DNA, it exonerates the Ramseys. Explain why that's the biggest crock of you-know-what
since the
beginning of time.
The then district attorney of Boulder, a woman named Mary Lacey, long departed, just out of the job and replaced by somebody else, wrote a letter apologizing to the Ramseys because she went to a seminar and found out that there's such a thing called touch DNA, and she determined after she sent the long johns and the underpants out for touch DNA testing at Bode Technologies, which is a lab that specializes in that, that the touch DNA left a trace from a male unknown donor, and also it matched the degraded DNA that is in the underpants, on the inside of the underpants, which was admixed with JonBenet's blood. So she wrote that and said, based on that, you know, case solved. It completely eliminates the Ramseys as contributors. And she apologized to them for any trouble we may have caused you. And I wrote a response to that, and I have lectured on this, and said that her exonerating them is ridiculous. She ought to be apologizing to JonBenet for doing this, because she is dropping the ball. And she, by the way, was a sex crimes prosecutor, so she really missed the ball in this case. But simply stated, the DNA that was deposited from a male in the inside of JonBenet's underpants was degraded and old. You could only get a partial marker there. And instead of getting a robust sampling, which you did from the blood was fresh. So that was robust. 13 markers, all of them JonBenet, no question about it. You get maybe 9 markers, much too little to do anything with. And they were probably from the manufacturing process. Dr. Henry Lee, who was the world-famous criminalist who worked on the case, said that is artifact. It has nothing to do with solving the case. Nonetheless, Mary Lacey and Bode Technology thought they came up with this new technique, and in fact, it's an old technique that the FBI lab had been using for a long time, touch DNA. If you touch another person, you leave a trace of sweat from your fingernails, maybe skin cells on that other person.
And you can have so, hundreds of bits of DNA from hundreds of different people all over you.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
Means
and,
nothing.
So why in the world did she say that this matches the long johns which somebody pulled down ostensibly to molest her, matches the inside of the underpants? It just doesn't make sense to anybody who knows DNA.
It's ridiculous.
So
it means nothing.
It's a painful thing for her to do.
It was a horrible thing for her to do. It was, to me, it was so outrageous. And Mary Lacey should not only be ashamed, but I swear, I wish she could have been fired for that. It was just absolutely ridiculous to exonerate. First of all, she's not a judge and jury. She has no right to exonerate the Ramseys and to exonerate them based on a partial degraded skin cell. One little, you can't even see it. I mean, it's not visible.
Right, well, we don't even know if it was a skin cell. We don't
right.
know what it was.
It was so degraded, we don't know.
And she did not offer any scientific proof of this theory of hers. And by the way, remember that she was the one responsible for the 2006 debacle where she arrested and brought
John
back
Mark
from
Carr.
Thailand John Mark Carr, who was the false confessor. And at the time when she checked his DNA, her quote was, "The DNA could be an artifact. It isn't necessarily the killer's. There's a probability that it's the killer's, but it could be something else. No one is really cleared of a homicide until there's a conviction in court beyond a reasonable doubt, and I don't think you will get any prosecutor unless they were present with the person at the time of the crime
right.
to clear someone." So I guess she was there at the crime, and she's now the top suspect in my book.
And you know what? She's a coward because she won't take any questions about it. She goes and hides. She's despicable. She's a coward, and I would tell that to her face.
She doesn't have to explain anything to the public. She has to explain to other people who are scientists,
yes,
who have worked the case and who know better. Instead, she was induced for some reason to write this appalling letter and make it public. And then, as you say, didn't take questions, didn't
Nothing.
Answer, didn't
show up. Quick question. Forms for Justice poster, River Rap, brings up a good point. And, Donna, maybe you can confirm this because I can't remember. The same DNA was found in the other package of the new underwear that was put on JonBenet. It was a package of underwear. It came in a package of 3 or 6. I can't remember. Wasn't that same DNA found in those brand new underpants that were left in the package?
Well, I don't know that it was. I don't remember that. I know that Henry Lee went to Bloomingdale's in New York City and bought the same brand of underpants, 3 in a pack, and took them to his lab in Connecticut and tested, and each of them found unmatched DNA in each of the underpants in the crotch part. And his theory is it's from handling, or maybe
right.
somebody, you know, dropped a piece of dandruff or sneezed or coughed, or just, you know, when you're working in a plant in China, you don't have gloves on when you
right.
handle merchandise.
Exactly.
So it doesn't mean anything. It's called artifact. And hi, River Rat.
she's such a great lady. Donna, we are going to go to your friend, Dr. Glenn Lipson. Dr. Lipson, thank you so much for joining us. Before we get started on the case, why don't you give us a little background about yourself?
Let's see, I'm a forensic psychologist,
mm-hmm.
and I ended up getting involved with this because it didn't dawn on me until years later, but my grandfather was murdered in a place of workplace violence.
Oh my God.
So I've tried to understand why people do these sorts of things. It happened when I was 11, so I could see how that death really touches a family and affected me. And he was actually murdered by a coworker with a hatchet.
particularly gruesome
murder. And I've been retained on both defense and by prosecutors in a lot of murder cases over the years.
Mm-hmm.
And most recently, what I'm trying to do is do the type of training that's going to prevent the high amount of sexual abuse that's occurring in our schools, which is much higher than what occurred in the churches.
Mm-hmm.
They estimate it's about 1 It's about 9.6% of kids are going to experience sexual misconduct while in kindergarten through 12th grade, and that includes about 4.2 million children.
Good
so
Lord.
We're working on getting training and working with districts and trying to prevent the sort of things that we recently have seen in the news at Penn State, et cetera.
And what is the name of your website? Because I went on your website today, and you talk about this in great detail, and it's fascinating. Give us the address again of your website.
Yeah, it's, the title from the website came from a superintendent we're working with who said we got to help employees and students make right choices.
Mm-hmm.
So the name of the website is makingrightchoices.com.
Okay, Dr. Lipson, give us your view on the JonBenet Ramsey case, on the parents, their behavior. I mean, you can get into their mind as much as anybody can. Why don't you tell us what you think?
Well, definitely. Typically when there is a murder like this that took place and there's the level of violence and the fact, you know, you look at the facts, how loosely the hands were tied, that the ligature was gentle. A lot of this came from the autopsy work that Dr. Weck did. This is obviously someone who had a connection or a relationship to this particular child, and I am appalled by how, of course, the case was handled, how no one looked at the fact that there were signs of sexual trauma before the event,
yes,
which makes it unlikely that someone came in and this only happened at one time. And it is just one of these things where it doesn't make sense that if you have had something like this happen in your family, having had a murder in my family, I know about that, that you would just not try to understand or find what happened and respond to this the way it's been responded to. I have seen a lot of defense attorneys who basically, you know, try to use this formula of trying to immediately get families to never cooperate with law enforcement. However, if you are very upset and you care about it and you want to get to the bottom of it, I don't know how you can't.
Right.
How you can't give whatever information, whatever you can, because it has more to do with seeking the justice for your family member than it does in protecting yourself.
Mm-hmm. You are absolutely right. Dr. Lipson, you said you have worked for both the prosecution and the defense. Hypothetically, let's have a hypothetical here. Let's say that Linwood, John Ramsey's lovely defense lawyer, warm, fuzzy man, we all adore him, sarcasm included here. Let's say Linwood came to you and said, Dr. Lipson, I need to hire you as part of my defense team. What would you say?
Well, I basically would say that it doesn't matter which side anyone hires me on, that mm-hmm. I view myself as there to help the trier of fact, which ultimately is you want something to go to trial to have it resolved. And that's what I see my role being, because I think jurors and prosecutors who care want to do the right thing. So you try to give information. I have been retained on defense cases where if you sit down with the district attorney and present them with information, that may then influence how a case is charged, whether someone mm-hmm. seeks a death penalty, whether or not they accept that someone was insane at the time a crime was committed. So what happens is, I mean, by virtue of training, I do not approach this from an adversarial standpoint. And this ends up not being about me. It ends up being in terms of what's the truth here. And if, for example, you found out that someone did something, you try to understand what happened. Because the majority of homicides only take, seconds or minutes before they're committed.
Right.
And that changes things dramatically. And you want to understand what happened in those few minutes, and you don't want to define everyone's life in terms of just those few minutes. And you want to help present that information, because that then may help the process of justice.
So Patsy Ramsey, if she were alive today, could be somebody that you could look into and look what led up to her stress for that night, whatever she did, I don't know. I believe she wrote the note, that's all I can say for sure. You, being in your training, you could look at it and say, you know, well, here's what happened, here's how her life led up to this point. And you can kind of go back and retrace what happened to make her behave like this. Is this what you're saying?
yes, you go in and you try to say, what was the investment in the daughter? What was the over-identification? Mm-hmm. How could these things then contribute to a blurring between yourself and your daughter? And then how could this be expressed in terms of seeing a child as an object that you could then vent these feelings or desires upon? And then trying to integrate all that together. The ultimate goal then is to find a way to interview someone with some compassion and understanding that then provides an opportunity for them to tell their story. Because people want to tell their story.
They do, even though they're trying to hide it. I think you're right. Deep down they want to confess. Yes, who's jumping in?
Tricia, it's me, Dr. Glass. You know, Patsy has tried to tell her story many, many times.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's been told very differently during those times. And we certainly can't accuse Patsy at this point, or anyone. And I just want to say that this family is extremely litigious, and they've gone after a lot of people.
I wish they'd sue me. Let them sue me, because you know what? I would love to sit down at a depot with these people, but go ahead.
Well, so, I mean, that is something that, the public needs to be aware of as well. That's why a lot of people don't want to commit themselves in terms
mm-hmm.
of saying what they really think, because they don't want they don't want to be involved in any litigation. And there has been quite a lot of litigation. And you had mentioned
mm-hmm.
Lynn Wood, and he has been behind a lot of that. So that's a key thing. But having said that, it's very, very important to look at not just the family members, but, individually, but just collectively in terms of what was going on. And I think the psychologist that you just had on described it quite well. When you look at what really went on, what was the dynamics, when you look at Burke, I mean, poor Burke at the time, you really have to see that he wasn't getting as much attention. Everything
mm-hmm.
was focused on little JonBenet,
yes.
The dresses, the clothes. He was in the background. He was really doing nothing. Could that build up a lot of resentment? Possibly. Could that have created a lot of anger and passive aggression? Possibly.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something to look at as well. And just in terms of the whole family dynamic, even the dynamic after it happened, you know, how Patsy was just so protective over Burke. And that has to, also be considered, because you really just don't look at one of the family member's behavior. You have to look at the whole family collectively. So that's just
that's
what
right.
I wanted.
Dr.
Yeah.
Lillian Glass, thank you. And Donna Kaufman, go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to add great comments from these two.
Yes.
And about Patsy being somebody who may have tried to communicate in some way, she brought JonBenet to the pediatrician in Boulder 27 times in a 3-year period. And there could have been more visits when the family were their summer home in Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
But each time the doctor failed to do even a cursory inspection of the genital area, and had he done so, not an invasive test, but he would have seen some anomalies there that led the coroner at the time who performed the autopsy, Dr. John Meyer, to stop the autopsy and call in an expert with a colposcope so that they could do internal photographs. And that is when he determined that she had been sexually molested days, if not weeks, prior to her death. And it was
right.
a chronic situation. So maybe Patsy did know about that, and that was her way of trying to stop it, or trying to get somebody else to stop it. It
mm-hmm.
There's lots of great mysteries in this case as far as what did Patsy know and when did she know it.
And unfortunately, we will never know that. We do have a caller I'd like to go to. She's been patiently holding for almost 20 minutes. This is Giovanni. And hi, Giovanni. Welcome to Web Sleuths Radio.
Welcome. I'm actually a male,
but
that's okay.
I am so sorry. Okay, Giovanni, yes. Yes.
Please, I just want to start off that I admire you, and even though I have some disagreements on your point of view, I understand that you have the same goal as many people do, which is seeking justice for JonBenet.
Thank you, Giovanni. Thank you so much. And you have a question for Dr. Lillian Glass.
Yes, yes. I just want to say that I've heard some rumors. I don't know if you can confirm this or not, that Burke has autism, which I have as well. And I just wanted to ask, can that at all contribute to any behavior that can be seen as bizarre or cold or emotionless? It may not be, and that instead of...
Well, I didn't know about that. I mean, this is the first I'm hearing that he had autism.
Actually, it was that they were thinking of it, not autism. What's the other one that...
Asperger's syndrome.
Just a ridiculous rumor.
He seems, you know, in looking and doing research for your show tonight, I was looking on the different websites about Burke, and you know, he seems to be very social. He seemed to be kissing a girl. He seemed to be very involved in college. So you know, he's very high level. If indeed he has a problem, we don't know about that.
That was just a ridiculous idea that somebody had, and it kind of picked up speed. But you know, he's really blossomed as a human being in his college
year. Yeah, it seems that way.
But and he was cleared. He legitimately was cleared by authorities early on and continuously. So I feel for that kid. He's been through so much, and you know, I'm really proud of all that he has achieved in his life.
I'm sorry, Dr. Glass, go ahead.
Yeah, he did accomplish a lot with all of this. And again, we don't know. We will never know what, if his involvement was, if any. But just that little statement is always in the back of our minds, like, you know, I'm not talking to you. And that was like, why? Mm-hmm. Why aren't you talking to him? And what did you find? And, you know, that is kind of the biggest mystery. It's the biggest question that... will always be associated with Burke. What did he know, or did he have something to do with it? Who knows?
Exactly. Giovanni, go ahead, please.
Oh, okay. Yeah, the point I wanted to make was that if he, in fact, has autism, could he have behaved strangely and out of the norm due to his disability and not necessarily out of guilt?
You know, autism comes in many shapes, sizes, colors, degrees, variations. So, you know, anything could happen. We did not know 15 years ago as much about autism and Asperger syndrome as we do now. Now we're very, very sophisticated, whereas back in the day, very little was known. So we really can't answer that intelligently because we don't have that information. But that's a great question.
He was blind when he was 18 months old. He was that smart. He's super smart. He's a pilot. He is a high-functioning person in his real life. And, you know, just kind of a heroic kid to have been through so much. So I think that and the reason that the FBI and others eliminated him as a suspect from the beginning was that he went back to school within 2 weeks of the death. And if he had any kind of guilty knowledge or involvement, his parents could have easily kept him out of school and isolated or homeschooled him or something. They weren't afraid he was going to spill any beans.
Right.
Can I jump in there?
Yes, Dr. Lipson, please do so.
Sorry, it's Cynic.
Oh. Cynic, I'm sorry. Cynic, I thought it was Dr. Lipson. I'm going to be back to you because I do have one question I want to go with you. But Cynic is our resident genius here at Web Sleuths and Forums for Justice.org. Cynic, jump in. We'd love to hear from you.
Yes, with regard to Burke, I just thought I'd share something from Steve Thomas's book, Inside the Ramsey Murder Investigation, relating to Burke. Just a brief little section here I'd like to read. It says, this is under questioning by a psychologist. This is Thomas's recollection of how things went. The boy remembered his sister as being nice, but added, sometimes she bugged me. JonBenet would tickle him and rummage through his desk and find candy and baseball cards. Bernhard, this is the psychologist, asked how he was dealing with his sister's death, and Burke replied, I kind of forget about it. I just kind of go, and it says that he lapsed into sounds similar to Nintendo beeps. He goes on, what do you think happened to your sister? I know what happened to my sister. She was killed. But what happened? I know what happened. How was she killed? Have you talked to your parents about it? I asked my dad. where did you find the body? He said, in the basement. I think someone took her down in the basement, took a knife out. Losing words, he made a slashing gesture or hit her on the head. He said the house was usually always locked. His descriptions were flat and indifferent. Bernhard, the psychologist, detected no fear that the killer might come back for him or that Burke thought that the family was in danger. The psychologist said it was very unusual for a child to feel safe when a sibling had been violently killed.
Exactly. So, you know, there's a lot that we don't know about Burke. And instead of, you know, yes, he may have had some heroic efforts as an adult because he may have compartmentalized, he may have forgotten it, he may have tried to block it out of his mind. But, you know, there are many, many unanswered questions, and we're certainly not accusing Burke, but that was what Cynic just read speaks volumes to me.
Yeah, it does. Dr. Lipson, what do you think about what Cynic just read?
Well, there's a detachment there which could lead people erroneously to conclude potentially that someone has Asperger's. That's difficult. I mean, the level of social functioning later, since it's a lifetime disorder, it's a developmental disability, is such that you would expect to see someone have problems connecting and have relationships on even the moderate ends of Asperger's. It's pretty significant. It's now looked at the precursor to schizoid personality disorder.
Oh, interesting. I didn't
know
that.
Testified with Alan Lincoln, who's written much of the criteria in the DSM for it, in a case where we had an Asperger's child strangle a woman and then engaged in necrophilia, had sex with her after she died. And if you Google my name, you'll see that case online. But it's usually when a sibling kills another sibling, it's done a little differently. It isn't done with tying ropes, and it's often done with suffocation. And what, you know, often propels that is a level of envy and that of getting that attention and then wanting to get rid of that so they get the attention. So, you know, again, this is very unclear in terms of all these pieces of information that intentionally at times sometimes are put out and are confusing.
Cynic, you were going to jump in. What were you going to say?
Well, I guess a lot of people were, you know, certainly disappointed when the Boulder Police Department tried to contact Burke, and he essentially hid behind Lynn Wood and essentially refused to speak to the Boulder Police recently when they, as the state, tried to, you know, just ask him a few questions to see if he might have, you know, something he might remember that might, you know, further the investigation. Is it, given that and given his, what a lot of people consider sort of unusual, somewhat indifferent behavior back then when the crime occurred, I mean, I personally always thought it was very unusual that, you know, if the police, if you wake up and the police is calling with the, you know, police, there's all sorts of activity, he seemed remarkably disinterested in all that was going on. You know, I think a child of that age would be, you know, asking all sorts of questions.
Almost hysterical. Very scared, yes.
Isn't that indicative that, you know, he simply, you know, knew exactly what happened, or was his parents certainly must have had some sort of a chat with him and told him how to behave?
Dr. Lipson, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that when that happens, that sometimes people could engage in denial. They have different ways of defending. You begin to ask questions. What the key to understanding what goes on is what we call a discontinuity, and you picked up on one. A discontinuity is when behavior doesn't necessarily match what's going on. And the problem is there could be any number of reasons for that. There was a concept that came from the Cincinnati Trauma Group called the trauma membrane, and it was after the Beverly Hills Supper Club fire years and years ago. And what they find is people who had been in a trauma tend to form a membrane where they don't talk to other people or let anyone in. It's like a scab. And they close off to the world. So sometimes the unwillingness to participate or to talk about something is that circling of wagons, feeling no one else will ever understand. And you begin protecting each other. And
right,
that doesn't necessarily say what happened.
But one of the things that is very critical in terms of what was being read was that he, as a child, he was just so detached, and how he had no fear about it happening to him. If somebody breaks into your house and they take your sister, kill your sister, don't you think you're going to be next?
Exactly.
A lot depends on the psychologist.
All the information, and so I think that we're operating with him not nearly enough information to be having this discussion about this kid.
Dr. Lipson, what were you going to say?
Yeah. So the other thing is, I mean, having been on the opposing, you know, having been with panels of experts who've each done evaluations,
mm-hmm.
there's some experts who get no information, and in part what happens is there isn't an assessment relationship which is formed where you get normal behavior out of a child. There are some of us who, by virtue of appearance, by the way we connect, the people we interview shut down and shut off. That's why we need to have, for our opinions, observations across a wide area with repeated number of people before we form a conclusion, because it may be just the way the chemistry occurred between the person assessing the child and the person
right.
forming the opinion.
Exactly.
And
there's
so, we
so
don't
many
know
variables.
If it's, yeah, there's so many things to look at. But that in and of itself speaks to, you know, maybe there was a level of knowledge. We don't know. It raises more questions than it answers.
May I also say that what you're bringing up and what Dr. Glass said earlier reminds me of John Douglas, because John Douglas did his so-called profile having only the defense set of information. He did not have the police files. He did not have the investigative files from the authorities. He just had the Ramsey's interviews and his own feeling that people like that certainly wouldn't commit a crime.
Yeah, and that's
he only talked to Patsy.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And
well,
and thought that she was devout and lovely, and you know, he was impressed by, and of course Lou Smith did the same thing. They got schnookered and inappropriately gave evaluations in John Douglas's case, completely tearing apart his entire career,
yes.
which was built on appropriate information from both sides, or else you don't take the case. And other profilers, from Robert Ressler to Greg McCrary, turned it down because they didn't have access to the full complement.
That's right. Who was going to jump in? I didn't. That was Donna Kaufman, true crime author. We're talking about the JonBenet Ramsey case. Dr. Lipson, were you about to jump in?
Yep.
Who was it?
Go ahead.
This is Peggy.
Peggy.
He never talked to Patsy. He only talked to John.
That's
John
right.
John Douglas never talked to Patsy. He only interviewed John. So
how he could come up with that, you know,
right.
to clear the parents is just bad.
I didn't mean to interrupt. I just, that was just lopsided.
No.
So.
And I'd
do.
Like to add, I'd like
Cynic,
to add
go
that,
ahead.
And yes, I'd like to add that that's what prompted Steve Thomas to indicate that Douglas was going against all of his previous writings by, you know, saying some of the things that he did. One glaring example of a mistake that Douglas made was the situation with the wrapping in a blanket, and it's a kind of a typical, well, relatively typical scenario in a crime involving people that are closely associated, family members, and so on. That care is exhibited to the you know, to the person that's been killed by wrapping them in a blanket. In the case of a child, they'll put a favorite toy with them. They'll pose them in a particular you know, position that indicates sort of restfulness, that type of thing. All of these things were present, you know, in this case, and yet Douglas comes up with this completely contrary profile. It's just amazing.
Donna Kaufman
paid a lot of money for, and eventually, when everybody in the FBI and outside the FBI made him a pariah, he did return the money.
Donna, that's what I was going to ask you. Donna Kaufman, true crime author. We're talking about JonBenet Ramsey and the fact that John Douglas, only the FBI profiler, very well known, basically went against everything that he has ever taught other profilers about when he profiled the Ramsey case. He only spoke to John Ramsey and then basically cleared the parents. It was stupid. Did it really hurt John Douglas's career, Donna Kaufman?
It still hurts his career.
In what
and
way?
And now he's an independent, and you know, he has done in his life some wonderful work, but that shows you how one mistake can wipe it all out.
Why do you think he did that? I mean, it was so obvious. Was he thinking he could come in and he would be the savior, the one on the white horse who would turn it all around? I mean, it was so obvious. All of the clues were there, and yet John Douglas didn't even, you know, read his own book. Why do you think he did that, Donna?
Exactly. Well, and, you know, there are lots of myriad reasons based on what was happening in his life at the time. And I think you can read up on that on formsforjustice.org. There's a lot written about what was going on in his life and career at the time. He had
That's
just
right.
come through a major illness. And but also, this was the case to solve. This was the big fish. Everyone wanted to
mm-hmm.
be a part of it. It was there's still nothing quite like it. So
right.
I think, you know, he rose to that, but he was warned by a lot of people that he worked with and, you know, contemporaries in that very elite group of profilers, which you see every week, the same people on the show Criminal Minds. So he was instrumental in being an early profiler. Not, he didn't create the form, but he was there from early on,
mm-hmm.
and his contemporaries said, don't touch this.
No, this is so surprising to me because so many of the, you know, FBI behavioral analysis unit individuals are so well trained and so, you know,
yeah.
ethical and so wonderful, and
yeah, yeah.
and knowing that firsthand, I this is so surprising to me to hear because I had never heard any of this before now, and it's
yeah,
quite
still,
very surprising.
Still a lot
because
of
these the
him.
People in the behavioral analysis unit of the FBI, the behavioral analysis program, I mean, they're top of the line. I mean, they,
yeah.
these people are, you know, sharp and so skilled, and so this just absolutely surprises me what I'm hearing now.
Adana, you said there was
it was a betrayal to all of that, all of their training. I mean, I don't think I've ever seen anything quite like it, but the anger toward him continues.
You said there was animosity. Let's just talk about that a little bit. Can you expound on that? There's animosity toward John Douglas amongst the other profilers. What do you mean?
Absolutely. Absolutely. If you remember Frederick Whitehurst, who was not a profiler, but he was in the lab, and he was the guy who blew the whistle on improprieties in the FBI Quantico lab,
okay,
and
yes.
hundreds of tests were considered faulty, and lots of cases were overthrown. And, you know, you'd think that here's a guy that they really would hate. And I was at a gathering of FBI people when he walked in, and everyone said, "Hey, buddy, how you doing?" And there was
really?
No problem with him at all. But John Douglas, you just bring up his name, and you get a much different reaction.
Wow, that's just amazing.
One thing I wanted to say also, when we look at some of the players, you know, you had mentioned all the characters involved in this because we're talking kind of a peripheral people at this point. It's kind of interesting to note what happened with John Mark Carr, that now he has gone through gender reassignment and he's living as
yeah.
a woman.
Right. Now
kind
he's Patsy.
Now he's
Pardon
what?
Me?
Now he's Patsy. I think
yeah,
that
yeah.
his name is Alexis now. Alexis.
Yeah, but he
yeah.
wanted to be Patsy. That was the thing. He wanted to be. Oh, boy, that we could do a whole another show on that. That guy was just too freaky for words. He gives the transgender people are not like John Mark Carr, trust me.
Yes, thank you for saying that, because he was exceptionally violent
yes.
and hateful toward everyone in his family and in his midst, and a total anomaly.
Absolutely. I'd like to go to Dr. Lips. Oh, go ahead, Cynic, you wanted to say something.
I guess I just want to slam Douglas one last time here.
Please
he did,
do. When, please do.
At the time that Carr was arrested, Douglas was interviewed, and he said that Carr did fit his profile. So.
Oh, are you kidding me? Oh, my God.
I couldn't resist.
That is just yeah. awful. I'm going to change direction here just a bit. Dr. Glenn Lipson, we're talking about the JonBenet Ramsey case. I want to go back for a moment, please, to what Mary Lacy did. Donna Kaufman, true crime author Donna Kaufman, talked a little bit about it, and I'm also going to ask Dr. Glass about this too. Mary Lacy, the former DA, the one who inappropriately and I think borderline illegally cleared the Ramseys of any involvement in the case, she fascinates me. She is a character that I guess I'm just so frustrated by her, because she comes in, she clears the Ramses on this DNA that means absolutely nothing to the case. And then she refuses to take any questions whatsoever. Dr. Lifson, I'm really going to put you on the spot here, and you know, maybe you can't answer my question. What kind of person, what kind of psychological makeup would do that? It's just so wrong on so many levels. Do you know much about Mary Lacy? Can you comment based on your education and your experience?
Yeah, definitely I could comment, but I never know enough about anyone. But so let me suggest that one of the things you find is that people have an intense capacity to rationalize and to become invested in their own stories, especially if their stories give them a sense of power and a sense of authority. And that is one of the reasons why absolute power corrupts absolutely,
mm-hmm.
because people begin to believe in things. And there's a similar issue here with John Douglas. John Douglas thought that he almost had My Favorite Martians type antenna that could come up and he could figure things out and sort of divine, you know, what the truth would be. I remember sitting in trainings with him, and he would come across as, I get it, I have it, I understand it, and I perceive it. And when you begin to believe too much in your own spin and in your own story, that's the hubris that happens before your fall. And I think it's very easy in some of these positions to, assume that position and not recognize your clay feet.
Dr. Lillian Glass, can you comment on Mary Lacy as well?
Yeah, she could have been. She may have been in a position where she didn't want to make waves. She didn't want to do the work. There could have been a laziness factor involved. There could have been a, I don't want to deal with this. Everybody's cleared. Okay, let's go home. That kind of mentality. Again, she may have been charmed by the Ramses. Who knows what was going on with her? But whatever she
husband.
I'm sorry?
Oh, go ahead.
Well,
didn't
her husband have some connection with the Ramses?
Did he? Well, then
there a financial connection?
Because it's obviously, if her husband has some connection, then it explains everything. Because, you know, it's kind of like, well, okay, I don't want to deal with this.
Now, Peggy, what connection was that? I don't remember that.
It was through a bank or something, wasn't there? There was a John Ramsey connection there. Mary Lacy's husband is a banker, I believe. I'll have to look through my notes real quick.
That's pretty sickening.
But it was almost like there was so much, and I don't want to. I'm going to use the word incestuous, but I don't mean, you know, just
not literally.
Too many people,
right?
Too many people involved in the globe that surrounded this case that were you know, it was a CYA thing. I think, you know, they had too much. They were too selfish, you know, to go to JonBenet's rescue. On this.
What Dr.
She
Lipson?
Went above and beyond, if I can interrupt here.
Yes.
She went to Patsy's funeral. She bonded with them to a degree that was less than professional. But the other thing is, and I can't prove this, but remember when Darnay Hoffman was representing one of the people who was trying to sue the Ramses.
Mm-hmm.
And there were depositions taken, and both sides offered lots of, the other side, heralded by one of the Ramsey attorneys, turned in a 93-page report to a judge, a federal judge, and she hoped to get a similar report from Darnay Hoffman, but he never submitted
never
a report. So she had only the information from the pro-Ramsey side to make her conclusion that the evidence was likely that there was no intruder. And so that was a judicial ruling that was just appalled us, because how can you not realize that you don't have both sides here? And it's not the judge's job to say, hey, get me the paperwork. Mm-hmm. She set a deadline, and one side gave the paperwork, and one side let the ball drop. So I think what that put in motion was the people on the Ramsey team had a way to say, if you keep saying that we're suspects, we will sue you, because now we have a judicial ruling that says we're not. So it is a, even if you're going to prevail in a court hearing, a city or a county being sued eats up a lot of resources, money, time, and it's easier to just say, okay, well, there's not going to be a prosecution anyway. Let's get real. Okay, fine. You're all cleared.
But remember, remember Mary Lacey came out, and this is where she overstepped her bounds. After that judge's ruling, when the judge said that, you know, the parents weren't involved and all they had was the Ramsey spin on the whole thing. All she had was that information. Mary Lacey came out and said, I agree with what the judge said. The Ramseys, you know, are innocent. And then again, overstepping her bounds. I just want to go back to something that Dr. Lipson said, because I think you hit it right on the head there. In Steve Thomas's book, he talks about how Mary Lacey decided early on that Patsy couldn't have done it. It was before she even really got into the case, knew much about it, just decided that, no, a woman couldn't do this. And so you have an ego playing here as well. You know, here she is elected, and then, you know, she has the power to come out and do all of this and make her statement, her thought, turn into the truth. Correct, Dr. Lipson?
Correct. And you have something we call confirmation bias, and that is when you have a belief, you find everything that supports that belief. We talk about it in terms of therapy by saying that when you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. So what happens is she had her belief she came in with, and the closer the relationship with the Ramseys, the more you feel they're like you and they couldn't have done something like this, and then you find something from a judge and you align up the information to confirm your perspective, and then you have the power to make that pronouncement.
Dr. Lipson, what could somebody do to get somebody like Mary Lacey to come forward and talk to them, change her mind? I mean, I would love to talk to her. I'd be very polite. I would be very professional. I just don't know if there's any way that you could ever, somebody like that, if you could ever get them to see the truth. Is that possible?
It's possible, but it basically takes coming in with some new information that would suggest, hey, look at it differently. And it also takes the building of the sort of alliance where someone feels, hey, I understand how you came to that conclusion. I could see how someone could have come to that conclusion. However, why don't you reconsider it on the basis of this new information? So, I mean, it's something that has to be done subtly, because there's a tremendous amount of investment in terms of that public persona. So you have to have something that then provides a way to open a new chapter, and it has to be something that is significant for her to change her opinions.
Yeah, I just...
Opinion anyway. She's out of that job, and she is not somebody that we need to impress or care about whatsoever. She failed in her job, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, she did, but Donna, I would just love to talk to her and just say, what were you thinking, in a polite way? You know, why did you do this? How did you come to this conclusion? You know, like with the John Mark Carr thing, I remember I went on MSNBC and I said, all Mary Lacey has, as far as evidence, are emails from a professor at Colorado University saying that John Mark Carr did it. I said, she has nothing else. And nobody believed me, and it turned out that's exactly all she had. She was so anxious.
And forkforjustice.com is the number
.org,
one
.org.
I'm sorry, .org, is the number one place to read about that scam, which was, it's laughable now, but at the time it was just left many of us slack-jawed.
Exactly. Forumsforjustice.org, the people there were able to expose. It was Professor Michael Tracy and his scam and John Mark Carr, and it was amazing what the sleuthers did on forumsforjustice.org.
So, you were the one who encouraged it and funded some of the investigation. I mean, it's a real feather in your cap.
I did pour some money into it, as they say. yes, Sinek, go ahead.
Hey, Tricia. I'll further to what you said in terms of Mary Lacey's sort of early bias. I definitely find Mary Lacey quite a fascinating individual. Actually, in Steve Thomas's book, he makes this rather interesting statement. He says, Alex Hunter said that he thought Patsy Ramsey was involved. That was more than offset by comments from his staff. Deputy DA Mary Keenan Lacey said the body language of John and Patsy wasn't suggestive of deception and that men were not in a position to judge Patsy Ramsey's demeanor.
Oh, my God. That is just obscene.
Oh, please.
She was married to the fact that Santa Bill did it, too.
Professional? That's just absurd. It's scary.
Dr. Glass, what do you think of that? About the
well, her demeanor, that's what... You have to look at the demeanor because it's the window of what's going on. You have to look at body language, how she's coming across, her communication, what she says, what she doesn't say. I mean, they certainly looked at it at the when they looked at the ransom note that she allegedly wrote. So, you know, you have to look at everything, the statement analysis, the behavioral analysis, everything that's going on. So that's ridiculous.
Dr. Glass, if you saw John Ramsey today talking about the case, do you think you could still detect any sort of deception? I mean, as time goes by, does it kind of fade away, or is it just always still there?
No, there's always a leakage. You know, the body doesn't lie. The brain doesn't lie. It's really deep within the limbic system of the brain, and that it controls your movement. So even though you may think you're getting away with it, there's some little twitch or some little leakage of body, voice, speech pattern that comes out, and the truth does come out.
It does.
Is revealed.
And Dr. Lipson, what do you think? Do you think after all these years, John Ramsey can hold it together and still keep up the facade?
I similarly agreed with Dr. Glass, and that is eventually, someone will betray what's underneath the surface, what they're masking. It'll eventually bubble up somehow.
Mm-hmm. And that is true. Is it true, Dr. Lipson, that people want to confess? We've talked a little bit about that, just touched on it basically a little bit tonight. They deep down, they want to confess their sins if they've done something really bad.
It depends on the individual. You have some sociopaths who don't necessarily want to confess. They want to gloat.
Mm-hmm.
They want to let other people know what they've gotten away with. And that's not necessarily to confess. Some people want absolution, they want forgiveness, they want understanding, they want to feel less alone. But there are other people who just want to gloat and reflect and like talking about things because it terrorizes others.
Gotcha. Okay, understood. Cynic, do you have any other questions for Dr. Glass or Dr. Lipson?
I have actually a whole pile of questions, really.
Okay, yeah. Well, why don't you go ahead. And Dr. Lipson, can you stay for just a little bit longer?
Definitely.
And Dr. Glass, how about you?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay, great. Okay. And Donna, how about you?
Sure.
Good. We can, because we're going to do a little roundtable discussion. I don't know why they call it roundtable, because we're not sitting in a roundtable. But anyway, we're going to have a little discussion with some members of the forum afterwards on the radio show. But I want to get all the questions in. Cynic, go ahead. Go for it, my dear.
Thanks, Tricia. To some degree, they're directed to both Dr. Lipson and Dr. Glass. I guess I'll start with you, however, Dr. Lipson. With respect to the psychological term undoing, roughly a definition of it is it's a defense mechanism whereby a person tries to undo some act that they've done to help them deal with the situation. I hope that's somewhat accurate. I'd just like to sort of relate that to some things that were found in the JonBenet Ramsey case. JonBenet, when she was found, later in the autopsy revealed that her pelvic area was wiped down because that was evidenced by smearing and some fibers that were found in her pubic area. She was wrapped in a blanket, and as a matter of fact, in interviews with John Ramsey, he described it as papoose-like. So it wasn't just a blanket, sort of tossed over kind of thing haphazardly. And I'd just like to quickly comment that that's one of the mistakes that John led John Douglas, I suppose, to perhaps make his erroneous conclusion. He was told by the defense that the blanket was essentially just tossed on top of her. So that wouldn't necessarily indicate sort of a loving action necessarily. But in the if you go through the interviews that John Ramsey did, She said, you know, he said that she was wrapped just like a papoose, so totally encircled, you know, to me indicative of a pretty sort of loving action to protect her, perhaps against the, you know, the cold, the fact that she was laid on a, you know, cold, damp basement floor. She was, there's also evidence of comforting. She had a Barbie nightgown right next to her within the blanket, and there was also a doll nearby. There was also redressing. Despite the fact that she was, you know, there's evidence of both acute and chronic sexual assault, she was dressed in new, albeit oversized, underwear. And also, her long johns were pulled up. She wasn't left exposed. Does that indicate to you any level of undoing?
Well, it could indicate two things to me. Number one, what you find in different personality disorders is the failure to integrate different types of feelings. So what happens is anger, which causes a tremendous amount of harm and injury to children, including death, sometimes is not integrated with the love. People act loving and totally invested in the child, but don't know how to deal with the anger. So sometimes that's the expression of the other side of the coin. Doing and undoing, you typically find, let's say like in obsessive compulsive and other disorders, where you check to make sure the door is locked, to make sure it's locked, you open it again, and then lock it again. So it basically is something that at that moment is binding some anxiety that's present. This sounds more like someone who was expressing the other side of the coin, especially with the description which you're describing something similar to swaddling. Most people who raise a child know that one of the ways you soothe that child is you wrap the blanket in a way where it's folded all around it, so the child feels again as if contained in the womb, and it's one of the things you do with infants. So there seems to be a level of care there which might not have been an undoing, which could have been an expression of some other deeper, more loving feelings in terms of how these things were facilitated, but really worth picking up on.
Okay, Cynic, does that answer the question, my dear?
I think so. If not undoing, however, I'm reminded of a statement made actually by John Douglas said, when parents kill, there's generally a softening of the crime scene where they take a blanket, cover up the child, roll the child over face down or something like that. Isn't it still far more indicative of the fact that it was done by potentially, you know, either somebody that knew JonBenet very, very well, or, you know, in a loving relationship, you know, such as a parent?
Yeah, it is indicative of someone who's not integrated their capacity to love with their capacity to destroy. And you're right. I mean, parents can harm a child and actually also love that child and have both those feelings existing simultaneously. And the problems people get into is when they deny their own capacity for rage and violence and try to act in a manner where they present themselves to the world as more beautiful, and they don't have a capacity to deal with that ugliness.
You
so
know,
your concern of the concern that you could have that you could be toxic to a child, that you could actually hurt them because of some of the things you're thinking or feeling, could also be reflected in taking a child all the time to the doctor, being afraid that you've done something wrong because you may be harboring jealousy or other feelings underneath. So there's a lot of different ways that people do things.
That's one of the things I wanted to bring up. The fact that she brought the child to the doctor so many times could also be indicative that she might have Munchausen's by proxy disorder, where she may be causing some problems to the little girl and bringing her to the doctor. So you never know who's involved or what the motive is, but that should not be overlooked. 26 times is a enormous amount of time to take a child to the physician.
Absolutely. It's ridiculous, and you're right. It does indicate something definitely going on, not just with JonBenet Ramsey. We have Dr. Lillian Glass, Dr. Glenn Lipsom, Donna Kaufman, Peggy Lakin, and Cynic. We have Zoomama. We have all kinds of people here, and Cynic has a load of questions that we're going through right now as we talk about the JonBenet Ramsey case. Go ahead, Cynic.
Okay, this I suppose is not so much of a question as a comment, going back a little bit to the discussion about John Douglas, and that's with respect to another tremendously well-respected profiler, Greg McCrary. many people out there that have studied the case know that Greg McCrary was approached by the John Ramsey camp, and he actually turned it down. He made this statement on a in an interview. He said, "I know about child homicides. First of all, we know there's a 12-to-1 probability that when we have a child murdered, it is done by a family member, caregiver, or someone close to the child. Only 1 in 12 is committed by a stranger. And then when we overlay the fact, even as I knew them early on, that the murder occurred in the house, everything seems to have occurred in the house. The note was in the house. The note was written on a pad in the house. Everything was in the house. My instinct told me that the killer was going to be in the house or someone very, very close to the child. So I didn't want to get into the position where I was in the camp of a killer and somehow inadvertently defending a child killer," which is something that Don.
Well, that just shows his... Go ahead, Donna. Donna, you know him quite well, correct, Dr.
Yeah, he's a good friend of mine.
Right.
But he said this, and I've heard this from other FBI agents who worked the case, is that as soon as they saw the 2.5-page ransom note, they knew two things. One was this was a phony kidnapping, and two, the child was dead. They just knew it was a matter of time before we found the kid.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this didn't really fool anybody except their defense team, apparently.
Very good point. Very good point. Zinnick, go right ahead. You have the floor, my dear.
Okay. There's a statement that I've come across, which when I read it, I thought back to the CNN interview that John and Patsy Ramsey had on New Year's Day.
Mm-hmm.
First, I'll read his statements. It's actually from another profile with Pat Brown. It comes from a book, My Life Hunting Serial Killers and Psychopaths. The statement is this: "We find this often happens with people who are involved with the killing of a family member. That's one of the reasons we look back at the family when we see something like this. We look at the husband, the parents, whoever the victim had a close relationship with, because these people have to live day in and day out with the search, and at some point they get frustrated by it. They tire of the questioning and the wife or the husband or whoever constantly looking for the missing person and spend their entire lives doing this. They want to move on. That kid's dead. I want to forget about it. I want to start doing stuff. I don't want to sit here and dwell on this. The killer will bring the body back and dump it in a location where it will be found, and they can get that part over with. There's the body. We found her. Now we can move on. Of course, they don't think about the next part, which is that the authorities will actually investigate the homicide. The perpetrator doesn't think that far ahead." Now, in the statement, one of the things that the Ramseys indicated when they did the CNN interview, just following the murder, they said the Ramseys also told the national television audience that they were not angry about the murder of their daughter and wanted to move on with their lives.
Oh, my gosh. So it falls right into
volume.
That.
Yeah, that's big volumes.
Yeah, that was
that
done
really
at
does.
A time when they wouldn't talk to the authorities.
Mm-hmm.
But they talked to CNN.
Well, obviously the Ramseys knew something, and you know, John Ramsey still does, and I can certainly see that in his communication, non-verbally and verbally. But it's just so tragic that, you know, we the public who care so much about children and about children who have been in this position to be killed, you know, we want to know answers. We want to know this. And when the parents are holding things back or playing games with the press, this is disturbing. And it also makes us want to point fingers, even though they say, wait, we have nothing to do with it. And, you know, we claim our innocence. But deep down inside, something's not right. And that's why, you know, I tell everybody, trust your instincts. If you feel something's not right, it isn't.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Lipson, would you like to comment on that as well, about what Cynic just read? It was pretty fascinating, I think.
Well, I think that these events, when you've lost a child, there's an old quote from, I think, the 10th century, where when you're a mother, you carry that child under your heart for 9 months. And one of the most difficult things for parents to ever get over is the death of a child.
Mm-hmm.
And for them to so cavalierly say, we're ready to move on, let's drop this, just doesn't make sense to those of us who've been parents.
Well, it's appalling to parents. It's appalling to everybody. And it's appalling to, I'm sure, doctors in your field who are studying these types of people, because it's just shocking. They said so many, the Ramsey said so many shocking things over the years that we could, you know, go on forever. John Ramsey absolutely refused to have JonBenet exhumed to check out the ridiculous stun gun theory, because John Ramsey, in my opinion, knows the stun gun theory is false. But yet, he said on Barbara Walters, let her rest. You ask any parent of a murdered child, if we could exhume the body and find a clue, they would say absolutely. Now, it's not up to John Ramsey to exhume the body, but he could certainly put pressure on the police and ask them to do so. He refuses to do that, and that's always been their big thing, is that this stun gun was used. Well, here they had the opportunity to double, triple check to see if they could to find out if the stun gun really was used, and John Ramsey refused to do it. A lot of people have suggested that maybe John Ramsey put something in JonBenet's coffin. Now, there's nothing to indicate that whatsoever, but again, could that be a reason why John Ramsey wouldn't want his daughter exhumed to help find, quote-unquote, the real killer? We're going to wrap this up here with the panel of professionals and then continue our talk with the members of forumsforjustice.org and websleuths.com. Dr. Glenn Lipson, any final thoughts on the JonBenet Ramsey case?
Well, my thoughts are this: you know, you're left with a few different perspectives. One is, what sort of attachment did you have to this child if you could just not do everything in your power to try to find the killer? Or if you're involved in it, that potentially is a reason. But if you really love a child, that child, in your mind, should never rest until you find out who did this, to make sure no other family will lose a child the same way.
Absolutely right. Thank you, Dr. Lipson. Give us the address of your website again, please.
It's www.makingrightchoices.com.
Dr. Glenn Lipson, it is a pleasure having you on. I am so glad that we were introduced, and now that you are on my list, sir, I'll be calling you often, whether you like it or not, okay? Have you back on the show very soon. Thank you. Dr. Lillian Glass, final comments?
Well, I think the truth will be revealed eventually. It always is. It always comes to fruition. So we just have to be patient, and the truth will come out. We will find out what happened to JonBenet, definitely.
Dr. Lillian Glass at lillianglass.com?
It's www.drlillianglass.com.
And Dr. Glass, you are...
Glass.com.
Mm-hmm. Always so
and
great.
I should add, too, that if anybody would like their own body language analyzed, they can just send me videos, pictures. I'll be happy to do that for you, too.
Oh, that's one. Oh, boy, you know, I'm afraid to do that. I'm afraid if I sent you mine,
you'd send it back.
I'll tell
you what your relationship is with your loved one or somebody you like, or what's really going on with family members, and just my opinion, but might be worth a lot to you.
I'm afraid you'd send mine back with just a one sentence that says, lose my number or something, you know. So, I know you wouldn't. I think that's a great idea. I think everybody should do that. That would be a lot of fun. Dr. Lillian Glass, thank you. You're always so gracious in coming on our show. Thank you so much.
You.
Take care. Bye-bye. Donna Kaufman, true crime author. Do you want to hang around with us forumsforjustice.org members to chit-chat a bit?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
great.
I have a final
A final thought, please.
Question or statement here. JonBenet would be 21 years old. She would probably be finishing college now. She had so much ahead of her. For a 6-year-old child, 4 to 6 years old is when she did the pageants. That's when we found out how talented she was. She was learning French. She was playing violin. She could sing. She could dance. She wanted to be a veterinarian. She was just a charming, delightful little child. And who knows what she might have contributed to the world if she had not been, killed.
And that's the most tragic thing of all, what she could have been. And like Steve Thomas said in his book, she could have been so much more than just Miss America. She could have been... I mean, who knows? The sky is the limit, absolutely.
Right. I love that comment that he made. That was
I do, too.
statement.
Yeah, it was. It was. Cynic, since you're the genius, maybe you could look that up real quickly for us. I think it's the very last page of his book, if I'm not mistaken. But anyway, now I want to introduce somebody who she's jumped in a few times here tonight, Peggy Lakin. Peggy has been a longtime member of formsforjustice.org, as well as Web Sleuths. And Peggy actually wrote a book. And Peggy, what's the title of your book about the JonBenet case? And it had other cases in it as well.
Oh, it's Journey Beyond Reason. It's about JonBenet Ramsey, most of it. There's a short chapter I would like to have had more, but on Matthew Margolis, the little boy that was murdered in Connecticut. And mm-hmm. I was trying to think how old he was.
He was quite young.
That's another open case.
Mm-hmm.
I think that they know who murdered him, but nobody else. I think that the gentleman that is responsible probably is in Texas right now, which is really a shame. And
yes.
The governor's daughter. So they're just three cases that I found interesting through the websites, through posters. So
mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's a complicated book.
Well, Peggy, let me ask you something. Did you hear from Len Wood at all when you wrote this book?
No, I didn't. It was funny. One day we got a letter from an attorney, and I could see my husband turning like three shades of of pale, thinking. I said, "Well, you know, I'll just call Tricia.
Yes, I'll fix
it. She'll take care of it.
I will."
So, I don't know. I guess I worried about that very little because I thought there's nothing that I put in the book that isn't real.
That's just it.
All quotes.
They can't. They can sue you, but if you have the truth on your side, you will win. And we have back with us. Let's see, Zoo Mama, are you there, my dear?
Yes, I am.
Oh. Good, you're back and you're not clicking. You were clicking before, so I had to put you on hold. You're done clicking, thank goodness. Zoo Mama, any thoughts about what you've been looking on? Oh, before we do that, Peggy, is your book available on Kindle?
No, it's on Smashwords is where I have it right now. So
Smashwords. How do we get it on Kindle? Do you have any idea?
I don't know that it's on Kindle maybe through Smashwords you can get it on Kindle. Smashwords, you can get it downloaded right to your computer, and they have, maybe you can get it on Kindle through that one, actually. I'll have to check and see.
We should, because I think that's a great book for everybody to read. Let's go to Zoo Mama, longtime member of formsforjustice.org. Zoo Mama was one of the crew that went to Denver with us when we presented a petition to the governor after we realized Mary Lacey was just being a total ridiculous lunatic. We presented a petition to the governor of Colorado asking for a new prosecutor in the case. And Zoo Mama joined us as well in Denver, and she joins us now tonight on Web Sleuths Radio. And Zoo Mama, thoughts on the JonBenet case? I know you have a million of them. Can you kind of cut them down a little bit and tell us what you're thinking?
excellent program tonight.
Thank you.
I appreciated the thoughts from both Dr. Lillian Glass and Dr. Lipson. But, you know, I've had a question. All of the friends and relatives, the minister, the doctor, everybody that came over to the house that morning, because they were called, because the Ramseys called all these people to come because they had a quote-unquote kidnapping, have any of those people changed their opinion or mind at this particular time about what happened that day?
Donna Kaufman?
Not that they are admitting. No, not that I know about anyway, but if anyone cares to call me,
right.
I'd be very interested in talking to anybody who may have second thoughts.
That is a great question, Zoo Mama. You know, we might meaning me, might try and find these people and call and just say, hey, what do you think now? Don't you think it's time to come forward?
I have done that over the years. And,
have you?
And it's gotten me nowhere. But, you know, I think the thing that surprised so much many of us is how, you know, who calls all their family to come trampling on the crime scene? Well, no one thought it was a crime scene then. They thought it was a kidnapping, not a murder.
Mm-hmm.
And it shows how wonderful their friends are that they all said, hey, we'll drop everything on this Christmas, day after Christmas, and our friends need us. And then after the cops got it in the eye over that and, you know, that was used against them, their compassion of the officers who responded was used as a weapon against them for not keeping things isolated and not kicking people out. It was ridiculous. But once the public became aware of that, I'm still stunned when I hear about cases where people invite their friends over, and it happened in the Elizabeth Smart case,
mm-hmm.
where they called up their enormous family, hey, help, come on over and, you know, contaminate the crime scene. And, you know,
I don't get it.
I don't blame them. I understand why it happens, mm-hmm. but it sort of does happen a lot. And as a crime scene purist, it drives me crazy.
Well, and the thing is, too, I think we all need to remember the ransom note said, if you tell a dog, I'll cut her head off or something. I mean, so what do? They call everybody. And one thing I want to throw out there, because there are so many little things, and they're not little, it just keeps coming up. John Ramsey, in his interview that was made into a book, if I remember correctly, said something that he saw a van in the alley that morning, the morning that JonBenet disappeared, yet he never said anything to the police. I mean, wouldn't you say, hey, police people, look, there's a van there. Could my daughter be there? He never said anything. But yet, you know, a year later, he says, oh, yeah, I saw a van. I mean, come on. It just gets so absolutely ridiculous and absurd and so frustrating. And I go back to my story of how a lot of people will believe anything they hear. And when you have people like Jane Velez Mitchell going on and on about the parents being cleared, it's very hard to fight that when you, even though you have the truth on your side, you know, you don't have the mechanism like CNN headline news to spread the truth. And that's what we're trying to do with this show right here, is to always have some sort of record of the truth. Cynic, you've been quiet. What's going on in your mind?
Actually, I was trying to think back to what you said there about the van. I think it was actually a truck and I just recently reread Steve Thomas's book, so
mm-hmm.
That's probably how I happen to recall it. But Steve Thomas was just you know, puzzled by the whole thing too, because you know, it's like well after the fact he comes out with this. Similar to a lot of things that, you know, that they did, I guess take the you know, the latching the basement window.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, allegedly. I mean, you know, again, this comes out well after the fact, and again, if you suspect that an intruder potentially, you know, came into your home. And, you know, potentially, you know, came in through obviously something
mm-hmm.
like a window, as they, you know, as they sort of alleged and sort of spread through the media, then why would you wait so long to, you know, to tell, you know, somebody that, you know, that you latched this window? It's amazing. And there's so
it
many,
does.
So many
yeah, I think
like
the
that.
Van in the, I'm sorry, the van in the alley, that was in their own book, wasn't it? I think he said he saw a van in the alley and he thought maybe that's him, and, you know.
It could have been.
But he just casually goes back downstairs, and, you know. So those are in John's own words.
Right.
I believe that was in their own book, so.
Ah. Okay, yeah, it very well could be. Very, very well could be. Let's see. How about, I have a question here, and I'm not quite sure who to direct it to. How about Donna Kaufman, true crime author? I don't know how much you want to comment, and I don't mean to put you on the spot, but Jeffrey Shapiro wrote a story today, and it talks about the psalm that was referred. And he's talking about you know, I just breezed through it. Donna, do you think that has anything to do with it, the Bible and the Psalm and all of that? Do you think that there really is a connection that Patsy was trying to say something with that?
You know, I don't know what he wrote, and I have no idea what he's thinking when he does half the things he does, or if he's thinking. But I do think that the Ramses had this idea of, who are you to judge us? We will be judged by God and a higher power when the time comes. And for Patsy, she's, you know, probably being fricasseed as we speak. But, you know, I do think that, so I don't know what he was saying with Psalms or anything like that, but I think the Ramses used religion as a convenience when it was handy, and, you know, I don't know what else.
Yeah, you're right. He did. It was just kind of a strange thing. Jeffrey Shapiro, to remind everybody, he was the guy who taped the Globe people, and I don't know.
He was a Globe. He worked at Globe, and was a young cub reporter who was, after I turned, I worked freelance for Globe, and I was on the case since the day after the murder. As soon as we started seeing the videos, and we thought, oh, here's a good story, and my editor said to me, you want to go to Colorado and pursue this? And I thought, you know, I really don't have the clothes. I don't want to go out and buy cold weather. I'm like a hot weather person, and I really just didn't see how this was going to end. And are we talking like go for a week, go for a month? No, I can't do that. And so Shapiro got sent instead, and he was actually a good person to go, because he was able to get into a lot of the places just because he was kind of a fresh-faced youth, and he took to the job very well. But then it turns out he didn't have good judgment about understanding when people were hoaxing him, and so he was just kind of going in all directions and wrote many competing theories for everything.
Yeah,
and
he didn't seem
to just have any kind of common sense.
Well, he even
Well,
he went to work with Linwood and said if the Ramses were innocent for a while, like you said, it's just nutty. Hey, guess who's joining us again? Dr. Glenn Lipson. Thank you. I thought perhaps that we were taking too much of your time, so I'm delighted that you've joined, jumped back in with us, because we're going to chit-chat for a little while about all the finer points of the case. So, Dr. Lipson, feel free just to jump right in if you hear something that you would like to add to, okay?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for staying on with us. I really appreciate that. That's so sweet. Cynic, are you still there, my dear?
Yeah, I tracked down the reference, at least in Thomas's book. He says, the first big surprise came when Ramsey announced that while police were in the house, he used a pair of binoculars to look out of Burke's second-floor bedroom window and saw a strange truck parked behind a home across the road. It was the first that any of us had heard of this. I could not believe that the father of JonBenet had waited 18 months to reveal this information. If he thought it might be in the least way relevant to her murder, why didn't he dash downstairs right away and yell, hey, cops, there's a suspicious truck in the alley?
Exactly. I mean, right there. Right there. Can you imagine a prosecutor taking that to trial and saying, why didn't you? I mean, that raises so many questions. But we know there's never going to be a trial in this case. There's never going to be a conviction. But I think we will get the truth. I think Dr. Lillian Glass was absolutely right. We will get to the truth. Dr. Lipson, you know this case very well. We talked a little bit about John Ramsey, but maybe we can go into in depth a little bit more. What do you think about him? He seems like he's very controlling, you know, a CEO, very, what's the word I'm looking for? I don't want to use the word cold, but very controlled, I guess. Am I correct in my assumption there?
Well, he comes across as in charge, defining what he will allow, what he'll present. So you have a very different public persona which is put on. And we never really know what goes on behind the doors of the house.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes the way people in a community know their neighbors is different than what's going on in the children's bedrooms. It's different what's going on during holidays and at the dining table or at dinner. And that's behind the scenes that we never see. It's like a restaurant. You don't necessarily know what goes on in the kitchen. You know how well everything looks up front where the customers are.
Right. So you don't want to know what's in the kitchen a lot of times, trust me, after working in restaurants. But I know what you mean. You're absolutely right. Dr. Lipson, if you had John Ramsey and you were able to ask him some questions, what would you ask him?
Well, I would try to understand, you know, one of the things that I know from having done therapy is you typically try to go for affect.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to know how things, you want to help someone connect to their emotions. So you ask those sort of questions. Like everyone tonight might be imagining what it would be like if the little girl was alive, you know, in terms of finishing college and any number of things. But try to do something that would connect to the heart. And the way to get to that is through the emotions and chat about it. And, you know, potentially what you use is life's transitions to provide an opportunity to discuss things.
Mm-hmm.
And
that would be
is,
very interesting.
You know, yeah, after the loss of your wife and you know, under these cases, are there things that would have been hard for you to say while you were in relationship with her, that you were protecting her
mm-hmm.
by not sharing? And do you want to share those? Did you ever have any concerns about the twinship that existed between mother and daughter in terms of similar outfits, the pageantry, and you know a lot of the ways her life was structured to be successful in the pageant scene? So those are things potentially you would try to talk about. I guess the best thing, and I think when it comes to interviewing someone, is to do things in a rather open-ended manner where you know where you want to go and what you want to cover, but you give someone enough latitude where they could start telling the story and filling in the narrative. And you want to give them permission to do that.
Interesting.
And you give them permission to do that by being genuinely interested. And every one of your listeners and bloggers, of course, is genuinely interested.
Yes, we are. And I think John Ramsey would be not pleasantly surprised at all, but surprised at the interest that is still out there. And I'd like to go back to that first interview that the Ramseys gave with CNN when they asked for help to find the killer. And that's what everybody has been doing. And in reality, in my opinion, they didn't want the help at all. They were just saying what they thought people wanted to hear. Donna Kaufman, true crime author, let's talk about Fleet White for a moment. Fleet White, I've met him and his wife Priscilla, wonderful people. I really like them, as honest as they come. He's been through hell and back. I mean, we could do a whole show on the terrible things that have been done to him. He's been accused of just awful things. What can you tell us about Fleet White that morning? Let's kind of update everybody, because we haven't mentioned Fleet at all tonight. So you have the floor now, my dear.
Well, he was another person who he and his wife were called over to the house that morning. They were they had a Christmas Day party at the house for their family, and they had a daughter, Daphne, was the same age as JonBenet, and the parents were, you know, playing with her on with the girls on the floor and making beads. And it was a great thing. They have wonderful memories of that night. And so when they got the call the next that night or the next morning, JonBenet is missing, of course they dropped everything and came over, as did other friends. And this is one of the greatest things that forumsforjustice.org ever did, was to straighten out the mess that people brought upon the White family for doing nothing but telling the truth. And they were the first to encourage the Ramseys to speak to the police, to tell what they, I mean, they had no idea that the Ramseys were trying to evade talking to cops. They
mm-hmm.
didn't understand that. Why aren't you cooperating? And, you know, they became critical of that. And some of the books that are written talk about almost coming to blows with John Ramsey over this. And while Ramsey was protected by, you know, pretty much a goon squad, Fleet and his family were just mystified why there wasn't better cooperation. And when that became known, a faction of people attacked him and said the most insanely horrific things.
Ridiculous.
And those rumors got passed around, and it took Forums for Justice and a lot of good people, posters, who really went to the mat to rectify that situation, and it's all in archives there.
Absolutely, and yeah, forumsforjustice.org. I got to say, I was so proud of our members, and I know I'll leave somebody out here, but people like River Rat VP, Cherokee, so many wonderful people. Who?
Cold case.
Oh, cold case. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. See, I told you I'd leave
someone
out.
If you don't
out.
Know the case, you again just like we said about Jane Velez Mitchell, you think, oh, maybe there's something to it. But no, this was an absolute way to trash a reputation of a family who were dissenters and knew better and had to be nullified, and to show them who's, you know, their place, they were set upon by a pack of wolves.
That's right. They angry, rabid wolves. And if you go to forumsforjustice.org, all of that is there. Just look up Mystery Woman. I didn't even want to say what they said about him because it's so ridiculous. It's so awful. Cynic, I think I just have this feeling in my heart and soul that you want to jump in.
Well, yeah, there's plenty to say, certainly. Well, first of all, I'd just like to say that of course, websleuths.com has plenty of good stuff as well. But
oh, absolutely. absolutely. We're just going, since it's the anniversary show, forumsforjustice.org is the one that kind of started it all with the Ramsey case,
yes.
Justice
yes.
Watch and Forums for Justice, and that's where a lot of the things are stored. And so
yes.
that's what we're referring to. Oh, believe me, we're not trying to take anything away from websleuths.com. No. We have wonderful posters there, who are just as active and just as smart and just as incredible. But if you need some background with all the documents, a Candy Rose is a great place, and forumsforjustice.org. But anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say a Candy Rose, awesome as well.
Yeah.
I did a post recently. I did kind of like my little look back on 15 years here myself. And I just took a look because John Ramsey did a couple of years back, I think in 2009 was the last update to his little website that he has with respect to making some sort of comment about the case. So I thought, well, you know, let's just see if there's anything happening on the site now. So I went to the site, which is the Fair Justice Foundation, and not a word. You know,
not a word on the anniversary? Nothing?
Not a word.
Ugh.
And we'll have to keep in mind what he said here, too. He said, let me just find it here. Well, first of all, just without even, here it is. This is from, this is May 1st, 1997. A reporter asks him, what do you want to say to the killer of your daughter? John Ramsey, we will find you. We will find you. I have that as a sole mission for the rest of my life. Mrs. Ramsey, Patsy Ramsey, likewise. And, you know, again...
They haven't done anything.
Anniversary here. He hasn't done anything. We can go back to his, you know, his so-called sham of a foundation, Shoes, and I think you remember that from back in the day.
Again, I may just say all of that's on forumsforjustice.org as well, websleuths.com, but go ahead.
Yeah, you know, he had that sham foundation, you know, which he, you know, allegedly this is where he had the $100,000 reward and so on,
mm-hmm.
which just for those that are not aware was, you know, a reward that they supposedly did have out. That all shut down in, I believe, between the year 2000 and 2001.
Yes.
The whole shoes thing was ridiculous. It was supposed to be a program to help track pedophiles and so on. He was going to work on this.
Didn't do a thing.
Like I say, the whole his website at that point shut down, which was called something else at that point. Support Ramsey. Forget what it's called here. Anyway, he did have another website, and that went down. The foundation never went anywhere. The reward eventually, there's no word of any reward now. You know, this is from somebody that's, you know, said that his sole mission in life is to find a killer. It totally reminds me of O.J. Simpson. Mm-hmm. You know, his mission in life was to find the killer.
Working recently to do a new edition of his book,
yes.
But through a mainstream publisher. And it's going to be, I will betcha, the same kind of, oh, the media has us, you know, pegged as the killers, how mean everyone is to tell the
I've
truth.
I've always said, Woe Is Me sums up, his first book, and I'm sure Woe Is Me is going to sum up the second book. Well, the title is The Other Side of Suffering, you know, and he compares himself to Job in the Bible, you know,
how please.
Everything went, you know, so terribly wrong. It's like, you know, again, Woe Is Me. The world has, you know, been terrible to me. The press has been horrible to me. You know, it's just more of the same. Do we need
Dr.
another?
Yeah. You know what? I will have to say that I don't know that he did this. I'm being flippant when I say he's guilty. But he is somebody who should have been more cooperative and more upfront with the authorities, and he failed in that mission.
He certainly did. Dr. Lipson, you just heard Cynic describe the fact that, you know, he was going to do all these wonderful things and he was going to take charge and find his daughter's killer, and yet on the 15th anniversary, nothing. Again, I'm asking you with very little to go on, but you are the expert, and boy, you have been right on. I just love listening to you. What do you say about that?
Well, usually what happens is anniversaries with losses are very difficult times for families and for people.
Mm-hmm.
We're all here tonight recalling this person's life and how it ended and trying to understand. And so it's a way of closing a chapter that doesn't make a lot of sense to most of us, that there
right.
isn't even a statement of remembrance. And thankful for the people who keep this person's memory alive.
Mm-hmm.
All of us have to deal with our mortality and parents and people we know who've died, and one of the ways that they stay with us a bit longer is how we carry them in our heart. And that's why in some traditions people light candles at anniversaries of deaths, and there's different things that people do to signify that love and that connection and that meaningfulness that person had in our lives.
Mm-hmm.
And the silence is deafening.
That is a great way to put it.
There's nothing on that webpage.
There's nothing. There's nothing. He should be all over the media. I mean, you can't tell me that all of the cable news shows wouldn't take him in a heartbeat to talk about the 15-year anniversary.
Exactly.
And nothing. Nothing. It's just quiet.
Well, it goes back to, you know, the whole concept of we want to move on with our lives. You know,
and they have.
He has.
But
he's
to be
married.
Honest,
he's remarried again.
He would be criticized if he did that. So he can't win, really.
Well, but no, Don, I disagree. I think if he said he wanted to move on with his life, and he did, and he's not doing anything. If he would have done something, anything, then we couldn't have criticized him. We'd have to say, well, gosh, look, he's doing this. You know, I think he's the fact that he's done not even a little. He's just done absolutely nothing, and then turns around and blames all of us, you know, calls people like me beer can collectors and bored housewives, which, you know, I wear that with pride now. Every time I see an empty beer can, I collect it, by gosh.
Exactly.
But
now, do you actually wear it? Or
I do. I do. I wear it, and,
okay.
And I'm a bored housewife. I sit here and I do nothing. I collect and wear beer cans, and that's it. He's absolutely right. Boy, he's a smart guy.
You know when he'll come out? He'll come out just prior to his book launch. Not now when he should have, but he'll come out just prior to his book launch, which is disgusting.
Absolutely right. And what's even more, not more frustrating, but what is as frustrating is nobody in the press will call him on it. Nobody has the courage to say, Mr. Ramsey, why didn't you do anything? Where were you on the 15th? And why didn't you report the truck that you saw? And why won't you get your daughter's body exhumed if you think there was a stun gun used? And why? Nobody will. Not one single person in the media, and they should be ashamed of themselves, except for people like Donna Kaufman, who would absolutely ask those questions if she ever had the chance to interview him. And I can assure you, Donna, he's not going to return your phone call. John Ramsey will not.
I haven't tried. You never know.
You never know. Let's go to some. Oh, I'm sorry, Dr. Lipson. Go ahead.
I was going to say John's now turned this over to higher authority, you know, based on what we heard earlier, that he's mm-hmm. going to be judged by God and only God knows what happens. And rather than leave it to the imperfect perceptions of people, he's just going to leave it to God.
Well, boy, that's a cop-out right there, you know.
But, you know, there's also something that happens in the media, and I've seen it on this case and on Casey Anthony and, you know, Scott Peterson and many, 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 many of the cases we've all talked about, where the media is so eager to see a piece of footage or to see some story or video that they can only get from the people that they should be asking the tough questions of, that it becomes a reason to do the interview with the caveat, don't ask this, don't do this, or
yes,
we'll
they give you rules,
yeah,
absolutely.
And they have a publicist standing right out of camera shot, and so it's a very controlled thing. And I remember when Patsy and John were talking about JonBenet to Barbara Walters, and Barbara was zeroing in to some incredible question that she was ready to lob, and Patsy opens her purse and brings out a tiny little glove that JonBenet used to wear in pageants, and it allowed Patsy to tell a story that had nothing to do with any kind of tough answers or questions, but, you know, how cute she looked in this outfit, and to hold up this sweet little glove, and you knew that it used to be on her hand, and pretty soon we're at the end of the segment and there's no more time. So
that's media coaching. Media coaching is when you sit down with someone who says, you say, that's an interesting question, but let me show you this glove here because I carried it and I wanted to share it with you. So what you do is you learn to deflect and only bring up the points you want to bring up.
Yeah,
and that issue for an exclusive is that you accept the exclusive by surrendering the questions you want to ask. By mm-hmm. being able to scoop everyone, you lose the ability to seek the truth.
And that is appalling, because if we can't have the media be the watchdog on the people that try and get away with crimes and murders and white-collar crime and blue-collar and every color of crime, if the media can't be the watchdogs, if they'll sell out just to get a piece of video, that to me is one of the most appalling things about this. And unfortunately, we have seen it happen. I want to go to
a good example, Tricia, is of course Aphrodite Jones. She pretty much sold her soul for that.
That was horrible. I don't know if you guys remember this, but Aphrodite Jones, I used to love her, and now I will not talk about her books. I won't do anything to do with her. She did a story. She did one of her shows on the JonBenet Ramsey case, and she totally sold out. She worked with the Ramseys. The Ramseys got credit at the end for video, and it was one of the most, it might have just been a Ramsey infomercial. And I'd mm-hmm. like to thank Cynic, because Cynic on Web Sleuths went and did, we have it in the JonBenet forum, the rebuttal to Aphrodite Jones. And Cynic did all the work. I didn't do anything. He did every single bit of it. It was absolutely brilliant. And that's just another case. And I even wrote NBC. I know one of the producers there of Dateline, the executive producer. And I said, you've got to do something. This is appalling. And he said, I'll get back to you. I'll read the rebuttal and get back to you. And I never heard from him. They don't care. And what's so frustrating is, it's like when you know the truth and you're standing on a mountaintop and you're screaming it and the wind is drowning you out. And at the bottom of the mountain, everybody's telling lies and everybody's listening to those people. And you're right there screaming it and nobody is paying attention. And that's what I feel like is happening now. And that's, I hope this show will at least get through to some people somehow. Okay, I need to go
to Peggy. Well, and Ramses have been excellent about using friends of theirs in the media, typically Michael Tracy and a British team of documentarians,
yes,
to do not documentaries, but absolute commercials for their warped view of the case. And
yes,
they turned out, what, 3 or 4 hour-long programs and made tons of money on this. I don't think the Ramses got any, but they didn't need to because they had a PR team making documentaries that sold around the world. So that's where Jane Velez Mitchell, you know, unfortunately, she is given what she is given, and she doesn't do the homework that she ought to.
Exactly. And another good example of this, too, is 2 years before the John Mark Carr case situation, we exposed Professor Michael Tracy, who is the one who brought John Mark Carr to the attention of Mary Lacy and said he was the guy who did it, basically. We exposed Michael Tracy as a total liar, fraud, who made up suspects. I sent out a press release, everything. Nobody paid attention to it. It wasn't until a guy from a little Florida paper who called me up and said, "You must be getting lots of media calls." This was during the John Mark Carr situation. I said, "No, you're the first one." That guy, his name is Tony, I want to say Orlando, but that's not it.
Ortega.
Tony Ortega. He is now the editor of the Village Voice.
Mm-hmm.
And when he was made editor, one of the things that his boss commented on was his, you know, basic bravery in covering the John Mark Carr case and finding out the truth about Michael Tracy. Well, not to take anything away from him because I appreciate what he did, but all he did was call us and find out our press release, you know?
Right,
so
right.
It's out there if the media...
Which you've been
just
very generous about saying, hey, take from this, learn from this, here are the facts, here are the sources. You know, everything's locked up here. There's no question remaining.
Right.
And we can help you tell the story. So
yes,
take advantage of that, it's a good thing.
And I don't even care if they say, thank you, forumsforjustice.org or Tricia Griffith or Web Sleuth. I don't care. Take credit for it. Do it. Just get the truth out there.
Tell the story the right way, yes.
Let me go to Peggy Lakin. Peggy, a longtime member of the forums and a longtime crusader for justice for JonBenet. I just want to know your thoughts, Peggy. You've been listening all night. What are you thinking? What's going through your head?
Well, the show is extremely interesting. I've learned a lot. What I'm doing here, why I've been quiet, is I'm going through my computer trying to
mm-hmm.
find notes on things every time someone mentioned something. What the conclusion that I came to, and I didn't have a person that I thought for sure was responsible for quite a few years, but when I read the National Enquirer book, that was the one that hit me the most about how, and Steve Thomas's book for Patsy, to me, Patsy came across as being completely exhausted by Christmas night.
Yes.
And Patsy had to please John, and Patsy had to please her mother, and Patsy had to put on this wonderful, I'm a great person, and what can I organize for the rest of the world. I came across feeling sorry for Patsy, but I also ended up feeling that something terrible happened in a confrontation between her and JonBenet.
Dr. Lipson, what do you
Of Christmas.
Dr. Lipson, what do you think about what Peggy just said about Patsy having to basically, you know, please John and please the world? Do you agree with that assessment? I certainly do.
Well, one of the things that's interesting, there was a old psychologist now called Fromm. He talked about a personality called the marketing personality,
mm-hmm.
which is you acquire a wife by how beautiful, or a husband by how beautiful they look on your arm. And in that world, everything is about appearances, PR, and there's a tremendous amount of control and other things that go on. So that's where that discrepancy is between what's presented and what's going on behind the scenes. And it's those environments where there could be a tremendous amount of rage Because underneath that, when you live a life of presentation, if it is this sort of marketing personality, you're angry that people don't really know who you are, accept you for who you are, and it's very difficult to be a woman who needs to be a certain way in the world,
mm-hmm.
just like the daughter had to be a certain way in terms of how she walked and presented and her posture and all that.
Exactly.
So the amount of tension in that household at times must have been really dramatic.
I think you're absolutely right. Let me go to go ahead.
I'm sorry. No, I always, and the impression, I did a lot of background, like obviously searching back through, and I wanted to find stories about what Patsy was like as a child and how, you know, when she grew up. That to me was important to find out if she was responsible, you know, was that possible, was, or anything's possible, anyone can have an accent, but that's what I came away from. Just what I came away with was that Patsy wanted to be all things to all people, and she was always on show. I think the pressure from her own family was, Patsy, you have to be perfect, Patsy. And I don't think she could have ever admitted that she did anything that harmed JonBenet.
Peggy, you said that Patsy always had to be on show. Is that what you said?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she had to be all things to all people, and she had, and I believe one of the tours that they did, you know, she said this piece of furniture was something, and someone in Forms for Justice, you know, found out that it wasn't. What she had to put out there was that they were rich, she was beautiful, John was wonderful. I always thought John was a total cold fish,
mm-hmm.
And bully. And,
yes.
But when she's talking about, you know, how she worked for this Christmas, you know, they had the party before, they did the gingerbread houses, and all the presents, and she admitted, you know, that she was exhausted, but it didn't matter. She didn't want to go on the big red boat, but John said they were going. So Patsy was going along with it. And I think she was just at the end of her rope,
mm-hmm.
December 25th.
I think you're right. And I think
over the top, she had a Christmas tree in every room, fully decorated. She knew she was going to be doing the same thing in Michigan when they went to their winter house and had Christmas with his other children. So she was also tired. She was a survivor of a very serious cancer and not completely well at that time. And she was 3 days away from turning 40, which may have been a psychological trigger or depressing thing for her. I think John once said that the whole reason that JonBenet's persona was accelerated was because Patsy didn't think she was going to live to see her daughter grow up to be an adult. So
mm-hmm.
she wanted to, you know, look at her as if she were a pageant person, you know, an adult pageant teenager.
Just so sad. Let me go to Zoo Mama. Zoo Mama has been sitting there very quietly, and Zoo Mama, like I had mentioned earlier, is somebody that has been a champion for JonBenet since the beginning, and we all know and love her. She's been on the forums forever. Zoo Mama, what are your thoughts?
Well, listening to all of your guests, this has been kind of a, I won't say a rehash, but a remembering of a lot of different things, and I'm so happy that there are still a number of us, whether they have called in or they're on the website or anything, to remember JonBenet at the 15-year anniversary, and that she is not forgotten. There are still many of us that, you know, go back and look up things, or we'll get a click in the mind and say, oh, wait a minute, what about that? And refer back to our books and things that we have. And I it's a shame that we're doing it and we don't see or hear any of the family to
mm-hmm.
to speak on this point. And what a shame. But we love
You're
her
right.
and we will continue to do these things for as long as it takes until we find who killed JonBenet.
And Zoo Mama, do you collect beer cans too?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, good.
Absolutely.
Just want to make sure.
Happily.
We all do, according to John Ramsey.
I cashed mine in.
Yeah, Peggy. Peggy had so many, she had to cash them in and get that money.
Yeah.
Okay.
I was going to be on Hoarders if I didn't. So.
Cynic, I know you have more questions. Would you like to, what am I trying to say here, toss them out right now, or have we exhausted your questions?
Oh, no.
Okay,
first of all, follow up to what Zumama said, and hi, Zumama, by the way.
Hi, Cynic.
It would have been a good opportunity, obviously, not only for John Ramsey to have, said something on his website. It would have been a great opportunity for Burke Ramsey.
Yeah.
As well, to come out and say something. But anyway, that didn't happen. So I'm going to switch over to a rather serious topic and direct this over to Dr. Lipson. Dr. Lipson, it's been from time to time I see this on the forums, and it's one of the theories out there in terms of what may have potentially happened to JonBenet. And that's the concept of somebody being a situational molester. And I'm just going to elaborate on that a bit. There are people, and I've seen posts relating to this, and kind of goes back a little bit to what Donna mentioned as well. Of course, Patsy Ramsey was a cancer survivor. She had a couple of years where she went through, obviously some very taxing procedures to rid her of the cancer, at least temporarily. During that time, some people feel that perhaps this is when John Ramsey, perhaps feeling a little neglected, especially sexually, perhaps this is the time when he may have potentially turned to JonBenet and began a process of molesting her. And that is not in terms of what was found at the autopsy. And in terms of also the police investigation, the police brought together a panel of pediatric experts, and they found that there was evidence of chronic abuse to JonBenet. Whether that was corporal, sexual, that's not known. But what are your thoughts on this concept of being a situational molester, and perhaps somebody, such as a parent who's never, done that to any of his, prior kids, just because of the circumstances involved, would potentially do this?
Well, there are situations where if someone has those urges, they're more likely to act upon them. Most child molesters plan. They try to get access to their victims. They try to do it in a certain way. They threaten them. If the child then looks like they're going to tell the truth, sometimes they'll harm the child. So that's most of them. They're out there. They're premeditated. It's planned. The individuals who are unplanned or opportunistic, they take advantage of an opportunity, often have, as I said, these pre-existing problems. What happens is when someone slips and molests, they tell themselves it's not going to happen again. So they go through a period of the buildup of the urges, and then afterwards they satiate them, and then they say it's not going to happen again. They try to brush it over, and then the tension builds up and it happens again. So they're in a state similar to substance abuse of denial of their addiction and their attraction to children. So that potentially could happen, especially if there's problems related to someone's ability to be sexual in a relationship. But there are plenty of marriages that go through periods of time where there is a decline in sexual desire for a while, and then it reignites, and typically it doesn't lead to molestation.
Could it,
Cynic?
Though? Could it, though?
If someone has, they have to have that level of attraction. Most of us do not find ourselves attracted to children. That's not the way most of us are raised. We tend to be attracted to people more our age. In the sex offender instruments, they do find males, however, it's typical for them to be attracted to adolescent females in terms of different measures of attention and arousal that are used in looking at male sexual patterns. But
so
can
I ask
children,
a question?
Children that's young.
Yes, Peggy Lakin, go
would
ahead.
Would it have made any difference that JonBenet was, the way she was dressed and presented?
That's exactly
that
what I was
she looked like, yeah. looked like
looked older. Yeah, she was sexualized. But I mean, that's part of the reason we have rape shield laws and the like. It doesn't matter how someone's dressed. He knows she's a child.
Okay.
But could that have caused somebody who otherwise is not attracted to children potentially be attracted to somebody such as her, even though obviously we're dealing on multiple levels here. We're dealing with incest. Go ahead, sir.
Yeah, usually not. But what happens is, and this is interesting, if you look at the cognitive distortions of sex offenders, they believe that it is better for them to learn about sexuality from a parent who cares about them, that children are sexually interested at an age when they're not. So there's a series of distortions and cognitions they have that they use to justify their behavior. So what happens, again, this is something to answer the question. You need to get deeper in terms of understanding what this person's mindset is. However, sexualizing a child can help blur those boundaries. I mean, most people do not want their young daughters looked at as something sexual because they don't know who's in the potential environment in the room. I've dealt with churches where they go to admit a member into the congregation who's a convicted pedophile because the probation officer wants them to go to church and think of God rather than small children.
Oh.
But the people in the congregation who have the small children don't want anyone to look at their child.
Yeah.
So they get anxious. So the issue is, if you don't have problems, I mean, if you're more average, you don't present a child in a way where it could attract that sort of attention. Because you'll have some people say, listen, she was in the parade, people have seen her recently, so hence that could then bring the intruder. That typically isn't what happens. I mean, one of the things that's been alluded to is majority of violence and abuse happens from people you know.
Mm-hmm.
Who have a connection.
Oh boy.
And that's the likelihood statistically. What profiling does is it gives us a sense statistically of what the subject or the perpetrator could be like based on the relationship to the subject who's harmed.
Can I just jump in here, Cynic, real quickly?
Yeah, go for it.
To take this a step further, okay, let's say, you know, JonBenet, or let's hypothetically, we're not saying John Ramsey did this. This is a hypothetical. JonBenet is dressed up to look like a young woman, and there are problems in the marriage. Could somebody be drunk and just behave this way where normally they wouldn't, with all of these different, kind of like the perfect storm, all of these things happening at once, and then they do something that they normally wouldn't do? They don't have that in them in any way, shape, or form, but yet this situation presents itself and they have, you know, had a little bit too much to drink. Is that possible?
They will always have it in them. It isn't something that's created by the situation.
Okay, that's
so. So what happens is, and I've evaluated city attorneys who've molested their daughters in hot tubs because they had too much to drink, but they already had problems.
Okay,
it's,
I see what you're saying.
The existing problem, risk, vulnerability, and it's those factors that come together that produce the avalanche.
Mm-hmm.
It's that
okay.
perfect storm coming together. But you need that element of already having that level of attraction.
You've got to have that in you. Go ahead, Donna Koff.
May I add that in JonBenet's case, she had digital penetration, which could have been from a male or a female, but there was chronic abuse dating back a period of time from days to weeks. So whoever did what they did to her did it repeatedly, and quite graphically, her hymen was eroded. It wasn't burst. That happened from repeated chronic molestation with a digit or an instrument, not with a piece.
Can I, and I don't mean to get graphic here, but I don't know how else to put this, and this has been alluded to before, and Donna, you made me think of this. JonBenet had been wetting the bed and defecating in the bed. Again, another sign, defecation, at that age, at six, of, you know, trying to make herself unattractive. That might be what people would say, what professionals would say. She was having a real problem, I know, according to sources, Patsy was very agitated with JonBenet wetting the bed. Could the digital penetration and such been a form of corporal punishment, you know, with a wash rag and washing the child and getting angry? Is that possible, Dr. Lipsum, or are we just out of our gourd even to suggest something like this?
You know, that, I mean, I can't think most people would ever think of that as a form of punishment. We make the distinction between primary enuresis and primary encapresis, that's urinating or defecating. And typically the presence of urinating after someone's been, potty trained, is often a sign of trauma. And it's not uncommon to find it in sexual abuse victims, that there's that level of regression that they lose that previously attained skill, which most children feel really positive about.
Yeah.
It is humiliating for a child to not have control of their bowels, to defecate, and to urinate. One of the things that's unfortunate is something in psychology we call displacement, and that is you blame the person you're victimizing for how you're acting. You say they're the reason who caused you to act that way, rather than recognize it was your own lack of control of your impulses. When you blame them, similar to a scapegoat, you can then harm them easily because they're the cause of the problems.
I see. It's just your justification. Cynic, you had something to say?
Well, I suppose now that we've presented a few different options for the doctor to consider, I'll also throw out one more. Of course, there was another male in the home, and that's Burke. You could just have a classic case of playing doctor,
yes,
as well, which could account for it. Of these possibilities, the brother playing doctor, situational molestation by John Ramsey, or corporal punishment by Patsy Ramsey, which of those scenarios would you consider to be the most probable, if you had to pick one? I know it's obviously a difficult
right
question.
Right, and when I go through life as an expert witness, avoiding speculating and jumping to conclusions. So, I mean, typically corporal punishment regarding digital penetration, which is enough to erode the hymen, is not something you would necessarily anticipate as necessarily punishment. And then there'd be the issue of probably the mother had fingernails that you might find a particular type of tearing. And so, I mean, there's some interesting questions. I'd have to go back and look at the autopsy because I did know there were signs of inflammation and scratch marks.
Mm-hmm. But can I mention something?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Don Kaufman.
Okay. You have, if all there were the vaginal injuries and genital injuries, then we could make this, a parlor game or whatever. We could do that what if. But there was another thing. She had, she was gently, manually strangled before she went into, which depressed her vagus nerve, which caused her to have spasms from which she could not be shaken out of, and then she was killed. Then, during that process, she had a rope around her neck and also tied over her sweater very lightly, as if to lead her around, not to restrain her. So that becomes a different kind of game that may not have been poking her sexually. Perhaps the poking sexually that happened as a result as she was dying, which left the blood in her underpants, was to cover up the previous chronic assaults.
Mm-hmm.
Because otherwise, once she started going into spasms, she should have been carried to the hospital where the previous molestation would have been discovered, and
right,
that was a different thing. There was a point in which her killer or killers decided to finish her off and create a hoax of a situation. So it's the gestalt of it, the whole thing that you have to look at to get, and which is so interesting from so many points of view. It does not seem to be typical in any way.
In any way.
What is actual fact is it certainly isn't what a molester who would have come into the home and waited for the chance to pounce on that young morsel and have his way with her. That didn't happen because there wasn't a sexual act completed. And what kind of ransom note leaves behind the body? So it wasn't a real kidnapping. It was this mishmash of craziness.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the autopsy as the beginning and end point, it explains how the case went down, how the mystery went down. And I would recommend people read Dr. Wecht's book, Dr. Cyril Wecht, who wrote with me on two recent books, but his book that he wrote with somebody else is called Who Killed Jean-Benet Ramsey? It's a paperback, and it has very user-friendly terms for all the medicalese and, completely goes through every single piece of the puzzle and explains what it meant. Now, he's not saying who did what. He's just saying, here are the facts, and here's how it happened. And
here's how it happened,
order
right.
In which it happened. Because some people were confused about, was she bashed in the head first and then strangled and then molested? Nope, just the opposite of that. So
right,
the autopsy tells you it's a blueprint of what happened to her physically.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Lipson?
Yeah, no, it's, I mean, what Dr. Wecht wrote and this recent book that I read of Donna's, which is incredible, they're just very helpful in terms of giving you the facts you need to have a better understanding of
yes.
what went on. The very fibers that were present, the fact that there wasn't a lot of bleeding in the head injury, which suggested that the blood had already been cut off through the
mm-hmm.
ligature. There's a lot. It's Dr. Wecht did a beautiful job.
He really did. He is truly an amazing man. We had him on for our first JonBenet Ramsey show, and boy, that was a compelling show. As is this one. Our guests have been absolutely wonderful. And you know what? We probably better wrap it up here because we've been going almost 2.5 hours. And Cynic, I know you might have a little something to say before we wrap it up. Are there a couple of questions that you just got to know the answers to?
Well, there's actually certainly a few, but I'm going to try to limit it here. With respect to what Donna just said, again we're dealing with a hypothetical here, but if there was an intruder. Given what was found in the autopsy, with respect to the chronic abuse, there was also some acute trauma to the vaginal region as well. But given all that, you'd have to be dealing with somebody that had frequent and unquestioned access to JonBenet in order to come up with the chronic abuse. Plus,
yes.
You'd have to have obviously the incident that happened. This night many years ago where there was acute abuse. Just given that versus, all of what you know about the case, the seemingly indifferent behavior by the Ramseys and all that you know about the case, again, how likely is it, that there could be this misfortune where, this all happened to JonBenet without the parents knowing that somebody was, abusing her somehow. Then perhaps another unrelated case where, somebody broke into the home that night. That versus the fact that, or the other option that it was one or both of the parents were involved.
And are you asking me?
Yes, Dr. Lipson.
Yes.
Okay,
exactly.
Okay.
I guess this is a classic question, intruder versus parents.
What happens is, as we said, it is rarer when it's an intruder and it's an outside source. It requires someone to have access to the child unfettered for an extended period of time. But even what was taking place in the house would require someone to have access, the brother to be alone with the daughter and the daughter never to say anything. We don't have any information along those lines. I have had cases, and we had a horrible case in San Diego here where they had a young girl. They hung her in the closet on a meat hook at night.
Oh,
they burned her with boiling water. When they went into the house, both parents claimed they were victims of battered women syndrome. But they made the other children line up at night and also abuse the little girl. So
oh my
there
God.
Are Yeah, it's one of the worst cases in the history of the state of California. And when they were at the crime scene, they thought they had found gloves, surgical gloves, in the bathtub, and it turned out to be where her skin had sloughed off from the boiling water they poured on her. But
that just makes me sick.
But what happens is you don't know what's, you don't know the whole piece, who knows what happened. There is some consensus from Dr. Wecht and other people who believe that part of this looks like it could have potentially been accidental. So, there are a tremendous amount of questions, and it would be...
accidental in that... there was a sex act going on that got carried away, or a friendly assault, if you will, that went
correct.
Too far, and then it was a cover up after that. But
correct,
that makes it an accident, and that makes it not first degree murder.
Right. Well, I think Cynic and I think everybody here will agree that the likelihood of an intruder is just pretty outrageous, and it's insulting.
If there was an intruder or crazy Uncle Ernie that we've never heard about, that person would leave behind some trace
Something.
Of evidence, and there is none.
It's insulting
Correct.
When they try and push this on us. You know, it's absolutely insulting, and that's like, again, that's what. That's why I want to do this show, is to get it on record so people will have a place to go and to listen to. Okay, Cynic, I'm going to give you one more question, and then we're going to go on down the line.
Can I have two?
Yes, you can, of course.
All right. this one relates to going back to John Douglas. And the essence of his profile is that it was some sort of revenge-based intruder attack on JonBenet. McCrary, the profiler which we already mentioned, responded to this. He said that this crime was not about getting back at the father, said McCrary, who couldn't recall a case of somebody killing a kid to get back at a parent. He said, he goes on, if revenge on the father had been a motive, McCrary said, the killer would have displayed the body. He wouldn't have hidden it in the basement. The profiler said the body would have been placed in a manner to shock and offend John Ramsey if anger, hate, or revenge had been a motive. Additionally, he said that by assaulting JonBenet, killing her, taking her from an upper floor bedroom to a far corner of the basement, and writing a lengthy ransom note all negated a revenge killing. If that had been the reason for a killer being in the house that night, McCrary said, they would have killed the little girl and God knows if that's possible. Any thoughts on the whole concept of revenge, which... John Douglas seems to think this was all about?
Well, I mean, that opinion's very, not Douglas's, but the other opinion is very reasonable, because revenge is loud. Revenge is the letters, it's the writing on the wall, it's the demonstration of the body. Parents, however, I've been involved with cases where parents do kill kids out of revenge because they don't want the other parent to get it and lose the children. They lose the children in the custody fight. So they're going to show the other parent by killing the children. And in that case, kids are pawns. So it sometimes happens that children are hurt out of revenge. So that's the only point I disagree.
Yeah, a case where a child was hurt, but the guy who pretended it was a revenge case, it was just a defense attorney theory, and the guy was just a pedophile, and that was the best way to defend him. So, but yeah, it doesn't work.
Yeah, it's a strange world where pedophilia looks better if it's a form of revenge than if you're a pedophile.
Yeah, there you go. Absolutely. Okay, Cynic, part two.
Okay, actually, I'm going to cancel a question, but just make a comment, again, going back to something that was said a couple hours ago, I guess, at this point. That was with respect to the DNA in this case. I did mention on the previous show as well that there was a case, the Stephen DeMocker case, where DNA from three unidentified men was found in three locations, under the fingernails of the victim's left hand, on the victim's left hand, and on a cell phone held by the victim. and it was found that that was all a result of contamination at the autopsy level because, and it came from a previous decedent.
Wow.
Yeah,
so see, there you go.
That's terrible. And in the Ramsey case, there were questions about whether the same clippers that were used
exactly.
To her fingernails were used elsewhere. But, you know, it never went anywhere. No case is perfect. Remember Susanna Chase, who was the 23-year-old
yes.
girl who was killed in 1997?
There was unexplained DNA there as well.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And they ended up waiting well over 10 years to make an arrest in that case. And when they arrested the guy, she was bashed, sexually assaulted and bashed with a baseball bat and never recovered. 23-year-old beautiful girl who had left her boyfriend and was walking home was 40 feet from her home when she was attacked. Mm. And so the case was stalled for many years, and all the same Boulder cops and DAs worked on that case as well. And finally, a few years ago, they got an arrest based on DNA, and it was a guy who was a predator, who hated women, who was in jail on another offense. And because they kept sending her DNA profile, Susanna's DNA profile, through CODIS, they got a hit. So they bring this guy to Boulder, and they put him on trial. And his mother says, of course, he didn't do it. And but that was pretty much the only defense. And other people who he had attacked were very, very accusatory of him. Well, turns out the jury was asked after they convicted him if it bothered them that DNA from a female, one of his girlfriends, was on that baseball bat, as well as unknown male DNA. And they factored that in, but it didn't stop them from finding he was guilty.
And
so,
see, their common sense came forth.
Yes.
It's good to know that some juries have it, even though there's others which shall remain nameless.
That don't. Dr. Lipson, would you like to add some final comments and also give us the address of your website again, please?
Okay, I appreciated the opportunity to listen to everyone tonight. You have some wonderful listeners.
Thank you.
And bloggers, and I really appreciate what you're doing. I think it's important for people to get the information. We live in a world where DAs look at conviction beyond a reasonable doubt, and sometimes there isn't that level of certainty to proceed with a case. But still, people need to know the story and need to know what happens. Okay, my website is, again, makingrightchoices.com, and it deals with preventing child sexual abuse, the misconduct that is taking place in public schools. And it's training for teachers. It was a program that was designed by participation of students, PTA members. It's a collective. Everyone came together to try to do this. It took us 3 years to make sure that union people would allow the training to take place, and,
mm-hmm.
and parents felt good about the training, and we're trying to prevent this, because I'd rather prevent these types of problems than go in the court and testify about them.
Or worse yet, have taxpayers pay huge amounts of money because the teachers were not properly trained about how to avoid these kinds of sexual pitfalls.
Exactly, in lawsuits and such. And Dr. Lipson,
yep.
again, thank you so much. We are definitely going to have you on again. You're on our good list, so we'll be having you on more and more during the year, okay? Thank you so much. And let's go to Peggy Lakin. Peggy, author of, tell us the name of your book again.
Journey Beyond Reason.
And who
Journey
else wrote
Beyond
it with
Reason.
You? It was Delmar.
Well, you have some comments in there. And
no, but
England.
Who else? You had a Delmar England, yes. Our late friend Delmar England helped you with the book, correct?
Wonderful friend, yes.
Yes.
My comment is one of the things that Dr. Weck said that I quoted in the book was, this was like the perfect storm, and it was. So many strange happenings have left JonBenet, I think of her picture, and I believe it's one that Patsy painted, and it's her back is to Patsy. She's looking out across the field, and I thought it just, when I look at that picture, I think JonBenet represents a lot of children that have been left without anybody being brought to justice for what happened to them. So it's a heartbreaking picture, I think. And I really appreciate what's being done by everyone here to try and protect children. There's nothing more important in this world. So,
thank you, Peggy. And you are certainly one of the people that work hard for justice for JonBenet and for others who don't have a voice. You are truly an amazing woman, and I am proud to call you my friend, Peggy. Thank you for joining us tonight. And let's go to Zoo Mama, one of my favorite people, most favorite people in the world. Zoo Mama, final thoughts?
Well, this is perhaps just a rhetorical question.
Mm-hmm.
If and when Burke ever gets around to speaking about this, his life back in the house then or whatever, will we believe him? I guess it's just a rhetorical question.
That's
and,
a good point.
I haven't got an answer because I don't know whether I would believe it or not. But anyway, that has just occurred to me, so...
And that's
kind
a very good point. I think we will believe. I think we will believe him, Zoo Mama, if what he says is logical and not the ridiculous. You know, and I think if he just comes out and tells the truth, it will be obvious to us. Hopefully, Zoo Mama, you are another wonderful person that I am so proud to call my dear, dear friend. Thank you so much for all you do. And now, Donna Kaufman, true crime author, another dear friend. I'm just loaded with dear friends tonight. Donna, final thoughts, and then I have an announcement that I'm going to make, and I can't say anything else other than this announcement, and it's going to be really good. So, Donna, go ahead.
Well, Peggy just said something about which photo she loved of JonBenet. The one that I like is not one of her showgirl poses or a pageant pose, but it's when she's in a little swimsuit on at the rudder of a boat. And it was on, I think, one of the, was it at the back of Steve Thomas's book or Larry Schiller's book or the Ramsey
yeah,
book?
Yeah, I know which one you mean.
Just a cute picture with no makeup. She looks like a 4 or 5-year-old kid, and that's what I think of when I think of her, and I think of her often. You know, I was at a party the other night, and as that witching hour approached, a boulder time, I was thinking, oh gosh, I know what's happening now 15 years ago. But,
mm-hmm.
you know, I do that. I did it on Christmas Eve with Lacey Peterson. And,
yes.
You know, there are just so many cases that that get to our hearts and we relive. And I'm really grateful to have forumsforjustice.org and websleuth.com and Tricia Griffith, who keeps it all bouncing along. And with such grace and intelligence and the people who post there, I salute you all.
They are wonderful. And a lot of people don't know this, and I'm going to embarrass Donna, but Donna does a lot of work, 99.99% of it for free, pro bono, in helping victims and their families and helping get justice in the world. So thank you, Donna. Thank you very, very much. Okay. Hey, you know what? We almost went 3 hours tonight, everybody. Let's see here. I want to thank Kimster. Kimster, are you there, my dear?
Yes, I am.
Oh, yes, you are. I just want to say thank you. It's been a busy, busy night, and thank you for everything that you do. You're here every week, and you are just such a doll. I just wanted to say thank you. And, oh, next week, we will be on again at a special date and time. It will be January 2nd, and it's going to be our year in review. It's going to be a very good show, January 2nd. We'll probably do it again at 9 p.m. Eastern time. And I'm booking the guests right now as we speak. And then after that, we'll be back to our normal Sunday night, 8 p.m. Eastern. Okay, here is what I have to say, and I can say no more. So please don't ask me, but you have to trust me and believe me when I tell you this. Something really good is going to happen this year with the JonBenet Ramsey case. And that's all I can say. Just
this
trust
year?
Me. This year.
You mean in
2012, right. This coming
okay.
year. This coming
okay,
year.
Good.
Something really good is going to happen this coming year with the JonBenet Ramsey case. Trust me on this, my friend. Okay, that wraps it up. It's Web Sleuths Radio, where we discuss everything, current events, true crime, and we always discuss it with common sense. Thank you, everybody. Good night.
Thanks, Tricia.
Thank you, Tricia. Good night.
Bye-bye.
Good night.
Good night.